Call this meeting of the Energy Policy and Finance Division to order. Appearances to the contrary notwithstanding, we do have a quorum. For those of you who are not familiar with the processes around here, members check in and then leave to go to some other committee. There are committees meeting probably in every hearing room in the building this evening. So that's not an unusual occurrence. But we have had a sufficient number of members to check in to officially convene the meeting. A couple of things before we begin. One, last evening at the joint hearing with the Legislative Energy Commission, we had a number of disruptions due to cell phones going off with members of the audience. These are kind of technical issues that we're dealing with here, and I would suggest to anyone who has not yet mastered the ability to turn off your cell phone that probably you're not going to get a whole lot out of this meeting anyway. So, but if that remains to be a problem, Mr. Pomeroy is willing to offer technical assistance to anyone who can't manage to turn off their cell phone. We do have on the list of people who have asked to testify 24 names. I had hoped that we would be able to start this meeting at 6:30 when it was scheduled to start, but it appears that actually it's going to start at 7 o'clock. If we give everybody who's listed here 5 minutes to testify, that would quick do the math, 2 hours. That doesn't leave any time for questions. What I had hoped we could do is ask testifiers to please limit their testimony to 5 minutes. If you find that what you have to say has already been said by somebody else, we would appreciate you just saying what he said or she said and pretty much let it go at that. We don't really need a whole lot of redundancy. And I do mean to give members the opportunity to ask questions of the witnesses. Last night, we asked members to hold questions until the end. And I think by the end we kind of were all exhausted. I don't mean to follow that procedure tonight, but please don't be offended if I cut you off if you follow 5 minutes of testimony with a 5 minute question. In addition to that, I do want to establish some time limits. Last night we went from 6:30 to a little past 10:30. I think it's reasonable, given that we've already spent 4 hours on this issue, to set a time limit of 3 additional hours with 2 hours of testimony and an hour of questions. If we are not done at that time or before that time, I mean to call for a vote on this issue at 10 o'clock. So with that, Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members.
Representative Mahoney, Representative Beard, do you have a motion?
Mr. Chairman, I do. I have a motion to move that House File 91 be, 1091 be passed and referred to the General Register.
Motion
I'm sorry. That it be recommended to pass and move to the General Register. There we go.
Thank you, Representative Beard. Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr.
Your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members. Thank you for participating in this extensive but important discussion over the last 2 days about nuclear energy. Access to safe, reliable, low-carbon domestic energy is a critical issue facing both our state and our nation. The bill before you today, House File 1091, lifts the prohibition to issue a certificate of need for a nuclear power plant in Minnesota. It just calls for a conversation. Its purpose is to expand the conversation about ways to address our state's future energy needs. This world has changed dramatically since the prohibition was put in place more than 15 years ago. Gas is less than $1 a gallon, and hybrids and alternative fuel cars were something we talked about, not parked in our driveway. In addition, the number of electronic devices in our homes has grown exponentially. It includes televisions in just about every room, multiple computers, game devices, as well as our many, many appliances. Two years ago, we set an ambitious goal of carbon reduction over the next several decades. For the sake of our children, our grandchildren, we must do everything in our power to meet and exceed these carbon reductions. Yet currently, we are prevented from even exploring whether nuclear power can be one of these options. Which can be an effective part of that solution? Under the present statute, it would be irresponsible for a utility to spend ratepayer money to conduct a feasibility study about expanding nuclear power in Minnesota. Our laws prohibit the issuance of a certificate of need. The year the prohibition was passed, public perception of nuclear energy, however, since 1994, public perception of nuclear energy has changed dramatically. We have entered an era with increasing public comfort about exploring nuclear power as a cleaner energy source. According to Gallup, the percentage of Americans favoring nuclear power has steadily increased. Currently, 59% of Americans favor the use of nuclear power, which is an all-time high. The same movement in public opinion is reflected at the federal level, where nuclear energy is part of the conversation about our nation's energy future. Minnesota should not be left out of that discussion. The Obama administration and his Energy Secretary, Dr. Stephen Chu, have expressed support for the continued development of nuclear energy. Just a few weeks ago, Dr. Chu said in a budget hearing, he believes nuclear power is a central part of our energy mix because it provides clean baseload electricity. Dr. Macanjani presented a persuasive argument last night for solar and wind power. Those technologies will also be playing a role in meeting our future energy needs. The nuclear energy is the only proven low or no carbon energy source that can handle our baseload needs today and in the immediate future. Nuclear energy is perhaps the lowest impact on the environment in any energy source, including air, land, water. It produces no harmful greenhouse gases, it isolates its waste from the environment, and requires less area to produce the same amount of electricity as other sources. In addition, the nuclear energy is safe and secure. Nuclear power plants are governed by strict government regulations and continuous training by the industry. At the same budget hearing, Dr. Chu, a Nobel Prize-winning physicist, said spent fuel can be kept safe for decades, and the safety record of Minnesota's nuclear industry is better than almost any other. By continuing the prohibition on nuclear power, we are opening ourselves up to the risk that a power plant will be built on our border, creating hundreds of jobs and millions of dollars in tax revenue for another state. For each construction, manufacturing, or operation job created at a nuclear power plant, four new jobs are created in the job market to provide good services. The employees at a nuclear plant earn salaries about 36% higher than the average earning in the community surrounding the plant. Not starting this conversation will keep Minnesota's energy future at risk. Members, we are part-time legislators. We are required to be experts on hundreds of issues, not just one. I've spent the last 3 years seeking to ensure professionals are making decisions about many issues around across the state, primarily building codes, and I have protected that zealously. I think people involved in the industry, people that work with the industry day in and day out, should be involved in that particular decision and have that conversation. Our utility our utilities, public utility commission, and regulatory agencies should have all energy options on the table when they set policy to meet our future goals. By lifting the prohibition, we are placing the burden on the utilities and the process the legislature has put in place to determine the best way for Minnesotans to access safe, reliable, low-carbon domestic energy. And then we must let the regulatory process work as it is intended. No energy solution is perfect, but a thoughtful discussion with all the options on the table is critical to achieving our goals. Thank you for your thoughtful consideration. I have your list of testifiers. I don't have much more to say. I don't think I'm going to get much more to say. So with that, I'll close and stand for the testifiers.
Thank you, Representative Mahoney. It's the chair of the intention that provided that they are present at the time they're called, we will just go through the list of testifiers as they appear on the agenda. So, first on the agenda is Mike Franklin, and I believe, Ms. Henkel, you meant to join him at the table. That will be fine.
No, Mr. Chair, I don't think I'm going to be needed in the testifiers, so if you don't mind, I'll just move to the seat right behind the table here, and they can all sit here.
Just stick around, Representative Mahoney.
Ladies first, if that's okay, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for this opportunity. For the record, my name is Annette Hinkle, and I'm president of the Minnesota Utility Investors. We're a grassroots organization statewide with about 27,000 members. We're encouraging you to support House File 1091. As you see here, and you will hear later on, we have a very unique group and a variety of coalitions supporting this legislation. We've got the Minnesota State Chamber, the National Electrical Contractors Association, the Minnesota Mechanical Contractors Association, the Building Trades, the IBEW, the Pipe Trades, Great River Energy, and then, of course, us, the Minnesota Utility Investors. A very unique and, I think, pretty powerful group working to support and to lift the moratorium. You've heard a lot of expert testimony last night, and you'll hear a lot of different perspectives tonight. But very, very simply from our perspective, from my members' perspective, they want the discussion. You know, Mr. Chair, we had a group, our members are very interested in talking about nuclear energy. They want to learn more. They're very interested in having that discussion. They have a lot of questions about the issue, but they want to discuss nuclear energy and have it be an option in addressing Minnesota's energy future. Now, some would say that keeping the ban in place does not limit the discussion. But from our perspective, as shareholders in these companies, but also as customers, as ratepayers, we don't like the idea of the companies putting time, money, and resources into something that isn't legal or isn't possible. So again, I would just strongly encourage you to send a signal to Congress that status quo isn't good enough on the storage issue and remove the moratorium, start the discussion with all the options available for how Minnesota is going to meet our future energy needs.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Mike Franklin. I'm the Energy Policy Director at the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. The Minnesota Chamber represents 2,400 small, medium, and large businesses all around the state, and we are also business electric customers. And wanted to thank you for the opportunity to weigh in, and especially to thank Representative Mahoney for offering House File 1091. And I'd like to start with some things that we don't believe 1091, what 1091 does not do. House File 1091 does not guarantee that a new plant will be built anytime soon. House File 1091 doesn't guarantee that everyone who supports the bill, including us, would even support the first plant that's proposed, or any particular plant that's proposed. In fact, House File 1091 doesn't even guarantee that a new nuclear plant will ever be built in Minnesota. Mr. Chairman, an important element of Minnesota's economic strength is the cost of doing business in Minnesota. And energy reliability and rates are significant parts of the cost of doing business. We recognize the significant challenges we face to meet our electric demand needs, which is why we believe the committee and the legislature should allow the option for parties to have a full discussion at the Public Utilities Commission. Mr. Chairman, members, House File 1091 is about options. Minnesota will need new baseload at some point in the next 15 to 20 to 25 years. And as you heard last night, and as you know, at the moment, baseload means coal, hydro, or nuclear. And so we believe all those options should be on the table for the commission. In summary, the Minnesota Chamber, representing business customers, supports the opportunity to put all those options on the table so that Minnesota's customers can continue to expect reliable, competitively priced electricity for the short and long term. Thank you.
Mr. Franklin.
Mr. Chairman and representatives, my name is Carl Crimmins. I'm the president of the Minnesota Pipe Trades Association. We represent approximately 9,000 members in the state of Minnesota. And we're the ones that build, maintain, and operate these plants from a pipe fitter standpoint. We work in these plants every day. We have members there every day. Safety record is second to none, as Representative Mahoney has stated. And we want, in our business, we always want to make informed decisions. And the only way to make a good, informed, well-placed decision is to have all the information. And all we're asking in support of 1091 is that all information, all the new technology be put on the table so that this committee can review it, dissect it, and make a decision that we can live with as Minnesotans for the next couple generations. When you're going to do an energy portfolio here for this state, everything should be considered. They're talking about new plants. New plants, is, again, as the chamber has stated, 10 to 15 years out. The new technology today, a new nuclear plant can be built in about 8 to 10 years, not 10 to 15 years. So technology is moving forward. We're hoping the state can move forward. We've moved great lengths in the last 10 to 15 years in technology and safety. And the nuclear energy industry in the state of Minnesota and in the United States is one of the safest energy industries in the world. Thank you.
Mr. Simmons, Mr. Anthony. Thank you very much, and thank you, Carl, my colleague, and the chamber, the associate, excuse me, for being here with me tonight. It is a grand opportunity when labor and business can come together and look collectively toward the future of Minnesota. This issue, it's been referenced in some articles in the papers, co-opted by myself and the president of the chamber, supporting this issue of lifting this moratorium.
Mr. Anthony, before you continue, we do need to have you identify yourself.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman. Dick Anthony, president of the Minnesota State Building and Construction Trades Council. In that capacity, I'm privileged to represent about 60,000 construction workers from all crafts, 15 crafts. We're very proud to be an organization that's been in existence through the construction of all of the nuclear power plants and literally most all of the power plants that have been constructed in Minnesota in the last 75 years. We think that this legislative session, we came up here with the idea that we need to create some jobs, and we've got some other legislation that hopefully will help some of these quote-unquote shovel-ready projects. This is not one of them. Indeed, the jobs that we're looking for today, many of the people may not even be born yet that will be in line for the training and the expertise acquired through the building trades to be able to continue the great history of building and constructing and maintaining through our brothers and sisters in the IBEW. It's a great record, proven commodity. We just want to be able to talk about it and move that, as Carl and others have said, the latest and yet to be developed technologies, talk about it to benefit the ratepayers and the community and the citizens of our state. So we'd appreciate your support in moving this forward. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Anthony. Are there questions for any of these testifiers? Representative Phelan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one brief one for any of the four testifiers. Do you know since the Subdivision 3B, the moratorium, has been adopted in Minnesota, how much federal subsidy has been applied to the nuclear industry at the federal level in terms of risk absorption and through insurance and federal loan guarantees?
Is that a trick question?
No, it's actually, I don't know the answer. I'm hoping that any of the four of you might.
We have someone here. Oh, Mr. Chairman, there is someone in the room that might have that answer. If we could bring them down.
We can do that to answer that question specifically and briefly.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Adrian Hamer. I'm the Senior Director of Strategic Programs at the Nuclear Energy Institute. I believe the question was how much subsidies does the nuclear industry received in risk and in research and development since, was it 1994? I don't know from 94, but what I can tell you is that since 1950, the nuclear industry has received about 9% of the energy subsidies, which is about $26 billion. Renewables has received 6%. Oil and gas and coal have received by far the largest proportion of those. And I'm already being requested from last night to submit a report to the committee, to another one of your members, of the BESDEC report, which outlines subsidies from 1950 through to 2006, and I'll be quite happy to send that to you.
Just a clarifying question, Mr. Chair.
Thank
you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Hamer, since 1950 includes the full impact of the Price-Anderson Act and the insurance guarantee beyond the $10 billion, the loan guarantees. I think I remember hearing last night that there's something like $19 billion on the table for nuclear. I just want to make sure I've been trying to figure out the answer to this question.
Okay.
We're doing apples to apples.
Yeah. Regards Price Anderson.
Mr. Hamer, last evening I allowed quite a lot of latitude because we were just entertaining expert testimony, and I did not want to interrupt the kind of back and forth that it was possible to have. But that really was kind of an exception from the normal procedures that we have in committees in the legislature, in which we go through the chair. Members are recognized by the chair, testifiers are recognized by the chair, and I just wanted to make you aware of that. So please proceed with your answer.
My answer is that Price Anderson and the loan guarantees are included, because on both of those there's no money that has come from the federal government. And then the money that will come from the federal government for the loan guarantees, because under the loan guarantees, the nuclear, the administration costs, the credit subsidy fee, are all paid by the applicant, which would be the nuclear power company.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Hamer. Mr. Kermans, before you leave, I do have a question for you.
Yes, sir.
You mentioned the time frame for construction of new nuclear facilities, saying that was not 10 to 15 years, rather 8 to 10 years. Are you aware of any place in this country or on the planet that a facility has been constructed in that time frame, or is being constructed on schedule in that time frame?
Mr. Chair, what I talked about, the 8 to 10 years, is these new style plants that are coming to the United States, and that TVA plant, because we're building these plants in shops now and moving in prefab shops, it's shorting the construction time frame. A lot of this 10 to 15 year number is taken into account all the permitting process that has taken to build the plant. The actual building of the plant is 8 to 10 years. Now, if permitting and licensing takes more, you know, that's something that I don't control. But I know the plants can be built at a shorter time frame now, and I could get information for you.
Just to get it straight,
yeah.
That's what we're told, but has that actually happened anywhere that you're aware of?
No, sir.
Thank you. Any further questions for any of our first testifiers? Seeing none. Next up, we have Bill Grant, and I believe, again, we're going to have Ms. Brown, Ms. White, and Ms. Carson at the table as well.
Mr. Chairman, Bill Grant for the Isaac Walton League, and if you would be so kind, we'd prefer to have Ms. Brand go first and have me follow her.
Certainly.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair and representatives, my name is Martha Brand. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy, the legal and scientific voice protecting Minnesota's environment. I'm here to talk about the issue of the storage of nuclear waste in Minnesota. This is a serious issue for many reasons, including our duty to protect the quality of life in this state for future generations. I think it's very important to remember that right now there are no options for permanent storage of nuclear waste anywhere. And there are some facts that we need to understand right from the beginning about nuclear waste. One is, it's dangerous literally forever. The second is, it's continually being generated at 2,000 pounds per year. Yucca Mountain had a design capacity of 70,000 tons, but 60,000 of those were already contracted for when it was being first designed, and the other waste was to come from military operations. So Yucca Mountain was never going to be an answer to any additional nuclear waste from Minnesota. You heard testimony last night about what Secretary Energy Chu has said about Yucca Mountain. And it took 30 years to get from the idea of Yucca Mountain to the proclamation that it is dead. Finding another permanent storage facility could take the same amount of time. So where does this leave Minnesota? We have two operating power plants here, Prairie Island and Monticello. They both date from the 70s. The issue of what to do with the radioactive waste generated by those facilities didn't really arise in a big way until the 1980s. There was this expectation that Yucca Mountain would be built. And in fact, many people don't know this, but Minnesota was apparently on the short list of sites that were being considered before the focus was really put on Yucca Mountain as the site. When it was clear that Yucca Mountain would not be available before Minnesota's waste storage was at capacity, NSP, now Xcel, began looking for permission to store temporarily this dangerous radioactive waste in dry casks, which are really 16 by 18 foot steel canisters outside the nuclear plant at Prairie Island. There was an environmental impact statement prepared for this additional on-site dry cask storage and an application of certificate of need before the PUC. The PUC then ruled that they could store 17 casks of spent fuel on the site, even though the recommendation of the administrative law judge was that it not be allowed for fear that it really would become permanent, which it pretty much has. The Medaquin Prairie Island Sioux community and environmental group successfully appealed that to the Court of Appeals on the basis that the storage needed to be classified as permanent and that NSP needed authorization from the legislature before the PUC could rule. The legislature then passed the law in 1994 giving NSP permission to store these 17 casks at Prairie Island. But the law then prohibited the construction of any additional nuclear generation plants in Minnesota until the U.S. had a functioning repository site for nuclear waste. And that was a compromise between shutting down those plants and having more nuclear waste build up here in Minnesota by allowing the building of new plants. In 2003, with the 17 forecast at Prairie Island, there was another debate in the Minnesota legislature on the waste storage. and that resulted in a special session law being passed for the storage of up to 48 casks at Prairie Island. In return, there were going to be annual payments by Excel to the Prairie Island Indian community to buy some land away from the site of the facility. In addition, the law then changed, so instead of having the legislature make these decisions, they were going to be made by the PUC. Then 5 years later, we had a request from Excel saying that they would seek 35 additional casks at Prairie Island, and there are evidentiary hearings scheduled for this summer. So, meanwhile, at Monticello, we've had the same thing. In 2006, the PUC approved Excel's request for a dry spent storage facility for up to 30 casks or containers, and this site was constructed. And we appeared before the PUC and argued against having them there being allowed to store this radioactive waste because there was no central repository on the horizon. These casks are really built to last between 50 and 100 years, leading to the possibility that we could have real contamination here. These sites are right down on the Mississippi River. And we have another concern that wasn't on the horizon when we first entered into that debate, and that is the possibility of a terrorist attack. So Moog, Monticello, and Prairie Island have long-term licenses from the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. Monticello's extends to 2030. Prairie Island currently expires in 2013 and 2014. There are two reactors there, but an application has been made for 20 years. So even without the construction of new plants, this problem is going to be around for a long time. So in conclusion, we would argue that the moratorium should not be lifted because the building of a federal repository is decades away. The sites on which these casks are stored right now are not permanent storage, yet we are in effect treating them as such. And there are many other solutions to our energy problems, to having reliable electricity. And those are conservation and clean energy sources such as renewal. And in 2007, this legislature put its best foot forward in making sure that we were aware of those opportunities and permitting them. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Grant.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Again, Bill Grant for the Isaac Walton League. I want to begin by reading you the Isaac Walton League policy concerning nuclear power. It's very brief, just 3 points. First point is that existing nuclear power plants should be allowed to continue to operate. Secondly, no new nuclear construction permits should be granted until full and satisfactory answers are available to questions concerning disposal of nuclear waste and cumulative environmental impacts of multiple nuclear power plants. And third, that nuclear power should be utilized only if all other least cost alternatives have been fully utilized, including efficiency measures and alternative sources of energy. We think this lays the groundwork for good policy in this area, and we think that it actually reflects current policy in Minnesota with the moratorium in place. Efforts to characterize Yucca Mountain, as you've heard, have been terminated. No other sites for permanent storage are under consideration at this time. The reprocessing option that we heard a great deal about last night has not been pursued in this country. It would be very expensive and would still require the transportation of waste and would still raise concerns about proliferation of weapons-grade plutonium. Storage of nuclear waste in dry casks is at best a temporary solution. As you've heard, those casks are designed to last no more than 100 years. It's a solution to a waste problem that needs to be in place for up to 10,000 years or more. I refer to that then as a 1% solution. We've got a 100-year solution to a 10,000-year problem. So without a solution to the waste problem, lifting the moratorium ignores the reason for establishing the moratorium in the first place. Minnesota has only just begun to tap its potential for energy efficiency and renewable energy resources with the passage of the Next Generation Energy Act in 2007. Even so, incorporation of efficiency and renewables into utility resource plans has resulted in dramatically lower projections of need for new energy and capacity from other generating resources. I would cite as examples for this Great River Energy's decision to withdraw from the Big Stone 2 power plant, in which they cited as one of the reasons for that the new state mandates for renewables and efficiency. Xcel Energy's recent decision to file what they call a notice of change circumstance at the Public Utilities Commission with respect to their resource plan, again citing the efficiency and renewables provisions. And just to give you a flavor for that, in terms of renewable energy, the company said in its filing, even considering the intermittent nature of wind resources, clearly there will be periods when available wind energy will supplant baseload resources to meet our customers' needs. And then with respect to demand-side management resources, the company said, further reductions in load growth through expanded conservation efforts could result in reduced or delayed needs or both. In addition to all of this, with respect to future baseload needs, the current economic downturn is also lowering utility forecasts of future need for baseload energy. I had the chance, in preparation for this hearing, to review the current resource plans of the four major electric utilities in the state, and with the exception of Otter Tail Power, who proposes the Big Stone Power Plant, which the Public Utilities Commission has recently approved a certificate of need for, none of the state's utilities see baseload power needs in their 15-year resource plans. The Office of Energy Security is currently embarked on a baseload study that was directed by the legislature, in which they will review the need and timing of baseload resources to serve Minnesota consumers. It might be wise for this committee and the legislature to wait until that study is completed before taking action with respect to Representative Mahoney's bill. And finally, I wanted to clarify, because there's been a lot of talk about nuclear power as a solution to the climate change issue. And this was an issue that the Minnesota Climate Change Advisory Group did spend some time on. And in its recommendation, which I think has been misinterpreted by some, the committee found that post-2025, the state should re-examine whether nuclear waste and safety issues have been resolved to the point where the state should once again consider nuclear power. So I know that that has been presented in other ways to you, but that was the resolution adopted by the Minnesota Climate Change Advisory Group. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Grant.
Mr. Chair, if it'd be all right, we'd like to have Chair Carson go next.
Certainly.
Good evening, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Tara Carson, and I'm a volunteer leader with the North Star Chapter of Sierra Club. I've been working with them for many years on clean energy issues. I'm also an environmental professional.
Ms. Carson, could you move a little closer to the mic, please?
Is that better?
Thank you.
Okay. I would like to start by briefly reading the Sierra Club stance because I think it applies. We oppose the licensing, construction, and operation of new nuclear reactors utilizing the fission process until, one, the significant safety problems inherent in operation, disposal, and international security issues are addressed, and the necessary regulatory structure is established to enforce these solutions, and, two, until proactive policies for conservation and energy efficiency are developed. In addition, the Sierra Club is deeply concerned that plant siting, mining, and waste storage disproportionately impact low-income and communities of color in the U.S. One point that I think is an important distinction to make when we're talking about our energy portfolio, and I don't think it's often made, we throw nuclear energy out there as though it's right on par with coal, natural gas, wind, solar, and other renewables. But it's really in its own solar system. None of these other options involve the enrichment of radioactive material or the storage of radioactive waste byproducts. And that's an important distinction given the testimony that we heard on both sides of the issue last night from the experts who told us that after 35 years of site research, we are no closer to having permanent storage than we were back in the early 70s. And no one seems to have a good answer on how we're going to quickly get that. I don't think we are going to quickly get permanent storage. So tonight I just want to briefly go through the international perspective, since nuclear seems to be back on the table everywhere. Everyone's talking about it a lot as another option. And I feel in Minnesota we hear a lot about how the international communities don't have a problem with it. They're planning new plants. So I think it's important to know the facts in this case. On the storage issue, Dr. Mahajani did talk a little bit last night about his experience in France, and he mentioned that no one has figured out the storage issue, and that's exactly right. No one has figured out a permanent storage issue. They're all dealing with the political problems with designating permanent sites. In the UK, after 2005, they had enough radioactive waste to fill the Royal Albert Hall five times over. And although they like the idea of building a deep radiological site, they do not have a designated site. Germany was designated, or rather they found some of the best geological substrate for a permanent site already back in 1977, deep clay and salt deposits. They've been studying it for over 20 years. In 2000, the studies were halted, and they have yet to resume today. Because of political challenges, and given what we know about Germany, they even though they are importing some nuclear power from France, they've really been working on their renewables. They hope to get off of fossil fuel and nuclear base, so they're unlikely to be willing to take outside nuclear waste material. As far as accidents go, there have been more than 35 minor accidents since 1971. I won't go into the details of all of them, but I do want to point out one that happened in 2005 in the United Kingdom, where 20 tons of highly radioactive nitric acid containing plutonium and uranium leaked from a cracked pipe, which led to a shutdown of the plant, and it is yet to reopen. And I think this is also important to consider as we see our two plants in Minnesota aging and the average age of the plants across the nation aging. On a financial basis, for new nuclear development, new plant construction, we find most of this in countries like Russia and China, where nuclear development is state-controlled, and also where there's state-owned utilities, such as in France. And the difficult thing about this is it's hard for us to know how much taxpayer money is going into this. They don't have to open their books to us, and they don't have to give us their bottom line. So they're really kind of black holes, and we're trying to figure out how much nuclear is going to cost us in the long run. France has had a lot of issues, and some of them were brought up last night, but a couple of things that weren't are EDF, which is a French national utility, has been raided recently by the European Union, and they have been charged officially with price fixing, and they believe it may be undermining competition throughout Europe right now. Areva, which we heard a little bit about last night, which is 85% state-controlled in France, was contracted to build a new Finnish nuclear power plant. They were supposed to open this year in 2009, but the costs have increased by 55% due to material and financial issues, and now they aren't even given an exact deadline for when they will reopen, but it won't be before 2012. And we keep seeing these delays and cost increases over and over, and that leads us to the cost increase in uranium, which we also heard a little bit about last night. But basically, in 2000, uranium was about $10 a pound. More recently, it's up to $60 a pound, and we don't expect those costs to go down soon because we are seeing a depletion in mines. And we talk about nuclear as baseloading, but it's important to know it's not infallible. France has had problems with shutdowns. They were forced to shut down several times over several summers due to summer heating, when some of their low-level releases that they have to do into the river were bringing the river temperatures up beyond legal limits. They've also had a problem with a reactor containment that had to be sprayed in order to be cooled down back to its operational temperatures. And we have seen similar shutdowns at a reactor in Alabama with overheating.
Ms. Carson, I should point out that your quartet has used all but about 3 minutes, so if you want Ms. White to say anything,
okay.
You probably should
draw
to a close.
Thank you for the warning. I just want to talk for a second about future growth.
The trend is going down. From 2000 to 2005, the average number of megawatts is 4,000. It's decreased now to 1,000 megawatts increase since 2005. And we're seeing, at the same time, exponential increases in wind, solar, and other renewables. Even the plant closings will exceed the base plant openings, even if everything that's proposed on the table today is built by 2015. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Deanna White. I'm the Program Director for Clean Water Action in Minnesota, and I want to thank you for giving me the opportunity to be here this evening. Clean Water Action is made up of more than 134,000 members from across Minnesota. We've been working on protecting Minnesota's water and people for more than 25 years. And on behalf of those members, I'm here to oppose lifting the moratorium on building of new nuclear plants. You've heard a number of very significant reasons. I want to just touch very briefly on the environmental impacts specifically. First of all, the mining of uranium, the source for nuclear power, causes radioactive contamination of ground and surface water. In addition, according to the Department of Energy, over 84% of the uranium used in the United States is actually imported from other countries. And I think we've all seen what happens when we rely on foreign fuel sources in the United States. I think that it's also important to talk about the water requirements of nuclear plants. They require as much as 83% more than some of the other fossil fuel options, and a single reactor can consume between 9 and 17 million gallons of water in a single day. It's a pretty significant use of a resource that's already limited. It's also important to point out that using this water for cooling of the reactors requires significant amounts of groundwater, and that power production is actually the largest use of water in our state. And we do have some charts, if you'd like to see them, about why what makes that so. In other words, it has a huge impact on our groundwater. It has a huge impact on our water resources. In addition, the water that's discharged from the nuclear power plants is typically warmer than the water in the discharge pond, sometimes as much as 25 degrees warmer, and that's really disruptive to the plant and animal life in these systems and can disrupt the natural ecosystem. In addition, as was already mentioned, in Minnesota, as is often the case, these plants are built on the edge of bodies of water like the Mississippi River, presenting a danger not just to that body of water and the immediate community if an accident should happen, but also to millions of people that live downstream of these particular sites as well. The draw on water resources and the need to put nuclear power plants near potentially sensitive bodies of water creates risks not just from possible accidents, but from the long-term impacts and demands on an already limited water resource.
And that's why I really do have to ask you to conclude.
Absolutely. The problems that existed when the moratorium was adopted haven't changed. The fact is, nuclear generation hasn't boomed for a lot of good reasons that you've already been hearing about. We have better solutions for power generation, and our resources are better put into researching new and innovative solutions than promoting dangerous old technologies like nuclear power. For all these reasons and more, we urge you not to overturn the moratorium, and I thank you for your time.
Thank you. Are there any questions for the testifiers, Representative Beard?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Probably a comment and then a question. But first, maybe the question is for Ms. Brand. And this isn't about whether we lift the ban tonight or not. That it's more about a comment you made about my grandkids that I want to talk about. And I've heard this several times before. The casks are designed to last 100 years. But who knows, in 50 or 100 years, maybe they'll be rusty and they'll be leaking. And then, of course, we've got the possibility of an event. Do we give our grandkids any credit for being smarter than we are? I guess that's my question. These are sitting there in a highly regulated, protected environment. Do you suppose that they might know that we're reaching a useful life and they could repackage these things, re-entomb them, or perhaps technology will have changed in 50 to 100 years and something else will be done with the spent fuel?
Representative, I appreciate your concern about your grandchildren, and I hope to have grandchildren too, but not too soon. But I do not think, I think that our grandchildren will be very wise and very smart. But it does pose a danger, because just the repackaging of the fuel is potentially a danger. And it would be best if we didn't add to that problem for our children and grandchildren.
Well, Mr. Chairman, there's a lot of things, you know, that sometimes rub me the wrong way, and this is one of them, that we don't give the future enough credit for being smarter than we are. and that things are going to remain static. So I'd like to just to bear that in mind when we're considering whether or not we should lift the moratorium, that perhaps the things that we're leaving our kids, whether it's windmills to be maintained or dismantled, or whether it's a nuclear power cast storage problem or something like that, I think they're going to be okay, and I think they're going to be able to figure it out that if there are little sensors around the edge of the pad, if you've ever seen it at Prairie Island, or the cast, the mausoleum, I call it, at Monticello, they're pretty pretty tightly controlled and monitored, and if they catch a whiff of something going on, I'm sure they're going to be up to the task of fixing it. One other thing I want to point out, it's going to be a statement just to correct the record. When it comes to the integrated resource plans, Great River Energy actually does have, Mr. Grant, a stated need of somewhere between 300 and 400 megawatts over the next couple of years. I think they withdrew from the Big Stone project, but I think if you check across the border in North Dakota, they actually have another unit or two that's under construction that's part of meeting that. I see Mr. Glahn is in the audience and is going to testify in just a moment here. And as far as the Big Stone partners and the Big Stone 2 prospect, those people already had their need for baseload recognized, which is why the certificate of need for the power lines was granted for the Big Stone 2 partners. And I just want that to be straight on the table because we've got a complicated decision to make tonight, and I want to be sure we got the card standing straight up. Thanks.
Thank you. Anything else for these witnesses? Seeing nothing, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Director Glahn, Bishop F.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bill Glahn. I am the Director of the Office of Energy Security and a Deputy Commissioner with the State's Department of Commerce. And with me here is one of my staff folks, Vincent Chavez, and I trust this will be the shortest testimony I give this session, and we're going to try to make this as brief as possible. And mostly what I'd like to do this evening is to offer up Mr. Chavez and myself as resources to the committee and to the public on this. We had your staff hand out a packet Mr. Chavez assembled. We tried to make it as fact-based as possible and provide the committee with information. Whether we let any bias creep in, I guess I'll let committee members to decide that. But we wanted to present as much information as we could to you to try to answer many of the questions that were posed tonight and last night, and I'm sure will be asked going forward, regardless of the outcome of this evening's vote. So I did want to just bring up a couple of points that I don't think have been brought up or perhaps received the emphasis that we believe should be given to a few of the points. Repealing the nuclear ban was a recommendation of the MCAG process, as you heard from previous speakers, not a unanimous one, but it was a recommendation of that process. We did include repealing the ban as part of the set of recommendations that were made jointly by my office and the Pollution Control Agency in a report that we submitted to the legislature earlier in this session. And we'll have a couple other comments to make, but I just wanted to let you know that you might recall Mr. Chavez from his days as our natural gas guru, but I hope his work reflects that his breadth of experience goes beyond that, and I'd like him to just point a couple of facts. We're hoping to answer a couple of questions that came up last night. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Director Glahn.
Mr. Hilty, members of the committee, representatives, good evening. For the record, my name is Vincent Chavez with the Minnesota Office of Energy Security. Last night there was a question as far as what is the status of regulatory activity in other states. I did look this over. I found that there are about 18 states that have restrictions on nuclear activities. I've divided that up into 8 categories. The first one would be the states that have prohibition or moratorium on construction. That would be Minnesota. The next category would states that require waste disposal by a federal government would be California, Kentucky, Connecticut, and Illinois. States that require waste disposal that waste disposal is operational and accepting waste products, there are five states. That would be Maine, Oregon, West Virginia, Massachusetts, and Wisconsin. There are two states that require that any nuclear proposal be economically feasible or advantageous to the ratepayer. That's Wisconsin and West Virginia. There are four states that have specific financing requirements for the nuclear power plants. I won't go into those in detail, but those states are New York, Kansas, Rhode Island, Connecticut. There are four states that require legislative ratifications to license a nuclear plant. That would be California, Illinois, Rhode Island, Vermont. There are four states that require voter ratification. That would be Maine, Montana, Oregon, and Massachusetts. The last category would be states that are revisiting the their nuclear legislation this session. That would be Wisconsin, Kentucky, and Minnesota. And it just cites to the specific laws can be made available if somebody so desires. The second part that I'd like to refer to or that I'd like to put into context is just a snapshot of Minnesota's current generation mix. Currently, 43% of our energy capacity is coal, 28% is natural gas, 13% is nuclear, renewables is about 9%, hydroelectric 1%, petroleum 6%. This has changed since I took a snapshot in 1990 with more natural gas coming on, going from 4% of the generation mix to 28%. What I've done is I was interested in seeing what that coal segment was actually about, so I plotted out using the data that we have on file in our lease database to see when those plants came on and exactly how much capacity they brought when they came on. I mapped that out over time, and just a quick snapshot, if we look at the current mix of or the vintage of our current coal plant fleet, about 13% is older than 50 years old, 50 years or greater today. If we look at 2025, that increases to approximately 45% of our coal plants will be equal or greater than 50 years old. As far as nuclear, once again, we have the three units, two plants. They generate they generate 1,646 megawatts of energy. Their current status is that with Monticello, they have applied and received a renewal for 20 years. They were renewal licensing for 20 years. They also have been granted an uprate, so an expansion of their capacity at the Monticello plant. This was granted by the Public Utilities Commission for 71 megawatts. As far as Prairie Island goes, they submitted their application to the NRC, and they are expecting a decision in 2010. As with Monticello, Prairie Island has an uprate or an expansion request to the Public Utilities Commission of 164 megawatt increase. That means that by 2025 and beyond, that the coal plants that are currently serving us will be aging and rapidly or over time. The nuclear plants that are currently serving our load with 16,000 megawatts will be done with their relicensing moving after they've moved it from 40 to 60 years in 2034. So the question is not what do we build new to meet new load, but what do we do to meet current load also? That concludes my remarks. I'm available for questions if you have any. Thank you.
Gunther.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chavez, very enlightening testimony. We have an infrastructure, aging infrastructure problem, I can tell.
As a year ago, last February, our MISO grid was at 97.5% capacity in February when electric demand is pretty low, or 600 megawatts from having shut down. How important is it to adequately supply power, not only for Representative Beard's grandchildren, but also for the senior citizens of Minnesota, nursing homes and hospitals? Are we going to, if we don't do something about our base generation in the near future, let's say 6-7 years, are we going to be subject to potentially having shutdowns, blackouts, kind of like California did when their legislature probably didn't have the foresight that they should have?
Director Glahn. Mr. Chair, Representative, I'll field that one. As the Acting Reliability Administrator, we take that charge very seriously, and we are concerned about an overtaxed and underbuilt grid. We have been advocating for the, and I don't want to get into a whole other subject, but we're advocating for the approval of the CapEx 2020 projects and other projects that will give us a margin of error to work with on our transmission system and provide that reliability. I think it's certainly true that baseload generation or any generation acts as a substitute for transmission if it's located close enough to load to relieve the grid. So we believe that the issue, as Mr. Chavez pointed out, is not just a matter of how do we meet future growth and future needs, but what do we do with our aging infrastructure where we haven't built a new nuclear plant in, you know, pick the date, 30 years, haven't built a new coal plant in 20 years. We've been relying almost exclusively, and we've been working very hard to develop our renewable energy resources, but we've been relying heavily on natural gas as our marginal fuel for all new construction. And we would like, and I'll just make this pitch, you know, we would like to answer all the very good questions that have come up last night and tonight. What are we going to do about storage? What are the costs of a new unit? How long would it take to get one up and running if you started today? And quite frankly, we heard a little bit about the integrated resource planning process that we assist the Public Utilities Commission on, but in our sophisticated modeling work, we have to leave the nuclear button off in our modeling work. Because of the ban in place now, we cannot do that rigorous study. Now, notwithstanding the hard work Mr. Chavez put into his presentation, we're not really able to take it that next step and answer definitively the many questions that have been raised tonight and previously.
Representative Obermuller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think this is a question to Mr. Chavez, and it's, I hope you can answer. I'm not sure because I don't see anyone from the PUC going to be on our list today, so I'll ask you. Under the current law, does the PUC, well, maybe I'll ask it this way. When Big Stone 2 was being proposed, does our Public Utilities Commission have to approve that plant or just the power lines coming through?
Mr. Chavez?
A large facility, energy facility, requires a certificate of need. So they will have to look at the plant itself. And what the legislation that is proposed today is just lifting or prohibiting a certificate of need being issued. If that's lifted, the certificate of need process will still be required for any new plant.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Obermuller.
I'm sorry, it's because I'm the new guy at the legislature. Sometimes I have questions that are basic, but I was my understanding is the Big Stone 2 plant isn't being built in Minnesota, so my question is whether the Minnesota PUC still would have to do the certificate of need on that.
Director Glahn.
Chairman Hilty, Representative, only because Mr. Chavez doesn't have the benefit of a line of sight to Dr. Haar behind you, I'm gonna stare at him and then take a gander at this. Officially, the Public Utilities Commission voted on approving the application for the transmission line associated with the plant, which is to be built and sited in South Dakota. And we have, through my office and the Public Utilities Commission, responsibility for the routing of that transmission line. But because of the nature of the project, the Public Utilities Commission, in considering the application for the transmission line, also considered the need of the regulated utility that was sponsoring the project.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Quick follow-up.
Representative Obermuller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So then my follow-up question is, I listened carefully to the list of states that were regulating and prohibiting nuclear energy at this point. I didn't hear the Dakotas. I'm wondering if the Office of Energy Security understands the current law to prohibit a nuclear plant from being built in the Dakotas and then the power coming into Minnesota.
Director Bond.
Mr. Chair, Representative, my interpretation would be if there were a transmission line that were required to bring that power to markets in Minnesota and that involved the participation of a regulated utility in Minnesota, we would probably look at those same sort of issues we did in Big Stone 2 in such an application. But if Minnesota wasn't involved as a market for the power and the Dakotas or any other state with sovereign powers decided to build a plant, I don't know what we would have to say about the matter.
I do have a question for Mr. Chavez regarding the 18 states that have some form of prohibition or impedance on the development of nuclear facilities. Are you aware, is there any activity in any of those, plans afoot to consider building a nuclear facility?
Chair Hilty, to my knowledge, no. Within our packet, we do have a list where the new plants in the United States are planned to be positioned. They're mostly in southern states, and I didn't find any prohibition in those states per se, other than Kentucky.
And Mr. Chavez, in states in which planning is going forward, do you think that those plans are such that there would be no implication for Minnesota? I mean, one of the concerns that I've had is that we keep hearing that if we have the moratorium in Minnesota, basically it precludes anybody from thinking about nuclear projects, basically. I guess my feeling has been that if planning is going forward in other states in the United States and in other countries across the world, and those numbers are such that it's clear that those are feasible projects that would be cost competitive, I don't quite understand the reasoning that says we can't pay attention to what's going on elsewhere and come to the conclusion that, yes, they do have viable, cost-competitive projects that meet all of the sensible criteria that one might apply, and therefore we should be thinking about undertaking the same kind of considerations in Minnesota. Do you think there's any reason that we couldn't do that in spite of there being a moratorium in Minnesota?
Chair Hilty, if and when those nuclear plants that are planned come online, it will definitely clear the way for a deeper understanding of the cost, of the time commitment, of the type of units that will be put into place or can be put into place. There's lessons to learn from that. As far as our own plan, though, that button is still not clicked on when we do the modeling because it's not an option. I don't know if investors that would undertake something along these lines would be interested in Minnesota as long as we have this. And there's a lot of pre-planning and posturing and business decisions that go into place before the plant actually is in the planning stage. So while we can learn from it and benefit from that knowledge, whether or not it will actually mean that we can build one or that option will be studied, not necessarily.
Thank you. Any further questions? Director Kwan.
I just wanted to conclude. I see we lost Representative Kalin, but I did want to point out that on page 59 of Mr. Chavez's work here, We did include a chart from the Energy Information Administration, which attempts to show on a per kilowatt hour basis the subsidies from the federal government to the various forms of electricity. And I don't want to engage in any debate about apples to apples or any of that, but just wanted to call that to the committee's attention. Hopefully it sheds a little more heat than light. And I did want to thank Mr. Chair and the committee for having this hearing and the hearing last night. We appreciate the chance to have our views heard and to air this issue, and I think we've all learned a lot, and I wanted to thank Representative Mahoney for carrying the bill and appreciate your efforts. Thank you.
Thank you. Next on the agenda, President Johnson, Prairie Islands.
Excuse me. Good evening, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Ron Johnson. I'm the president of the Prairie Island Indian Community Tribal Council. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. I'd first like to thank the bill's author, Representative Mahoney, for his sincere interest in the impact of nuclear energy in our community. He invited our community to submit suggestions for amendments to House File 1091, and we've discussed that possibility. However, our experience with the nuclear power leads us to the inescapable conclusion that until a permanent solution for dealing with the nuclear waste is agreed to, we must oppose lifting the moratorium on construction of new nuclear power plants or new reactors at existing plants. No other community in the state should have to live in fear of nuclear waste the way our community does. The Prairie Island Indian community is among the closest community in the nation to a nuclear power plant and its above-ground nuclear waste storage site. The plant's twin reactors and two dozen large casks that sit on a dry cast pad out there sit just 600 yards from our home. Since it went online in 1973, XL Energy, Prairie Island Nuclear Power Plant, has been a major concern to our community members with respect to safety, health, and environmental issues. A number of issues related to the operation of the plant have heightened our concerns, including two radiological leaks at the plant, which now is amongst the oldest operating nuclear power plants in the United States. The storage of high-level radioactive nuclear waste inside and outside the plant in 24 dry casks, which sit on a cement pad in the floodplain of the Mississippi River near our homes, businesses, church, and community center. The transportation of hazardous materials to and from the plant. For example, just this February, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission issued a warning against XL for shipping radioactive testing equipment from its Prairie Island Nuclear Power Plant last fall that emitted between 5 and 10 times more radiation than safety standards allow. Currently now, if the plant is relicensed for the next 20 years, there's 24 casks with the addition of 5 more up to 29 through this licensing period. After that, if they receive the 20-year license extension, there'll be another 35. By the time if the plant is relicensed after that, or if it's decommissioned, there'll be up to 98 casks sitting out on a pad with nowhere to go after the plant is taken away. That's completely unacceptable to our community at this time. 25 years after Congress passed the Nuclear Waste Policy Act and mandated the establishment for a national repository, the future of the nation's nuclear waste disposal program remains very much in doubt. The proposed spent fuel repository at Nevada's Yucca Mountain has suffered numerous political and bureaucratic setbacks and may never open. Officially, Yucca Mountain was scheduled to begin accepting nuclear waste in 2010, but now, if it's licensed at all, the Department of Energy says it won't open until 2020 or maybe later. Most concerning, President Obama has recently stated in his administration's intentions to completely abandon the project and has proposed cutting off funding all for Yucca Mountain in the future on this 2010 budget coming up. Prairie Island believes the federal government must deliver on its promise to move nuclear waste to a safe, secure facility before the nation embraces a so-called nuclear power renaissance. Until that happens, it's irresponsible for any state, including Minnesota, to entertain building new nuclear power plants and new reactors at existing plants. Thank you.
Thank you, President Johnson. Are there any questions for this witness? Seeing none, thank you.
Katie Hiamonga. Welcome to the meeting.
Good evening, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Katie Hiamonga. I am a resident of Wabasha County and the former mayor of the city of Lake City. I also served as a member of the advisory task force for the scoping of the environmental impact statement for the Prairie Island nuclear plant, for the extended power upgrade project, and for the request for additional dry cask storage. The question before you is whether or not to lift the moratorium. I would offer that it is not good public policy to lift the moratorium until there is a plan in place, a workable plan for the management of the radioactive waste that we already have in the state of Minnesota. I was born in Minnesota 50 years ago this week, 5 decades. And I don't recall specifically a lot about the building of the plant, but the memory that I do have that is specific is that the waste would be taken care of. And now it is 2009, and the problem of the waste is passed on to my children and to my grandchildren. And my children are smart. They are smarter than me, one with a degree in physics, another with a degree in chemical engineering. And I would offer that I might feel optimistic about leaving this problem to my children and grandchildren if I understood who is going to pick up the tab for managing this waste stranded in our state into perpetuity. I believe it is not good public policy to lift the moratorium until the problem of radioactive waste is resolved. That is my opinion as a citizen. I'm also here tonight to share with you resolutions that are in place, adopted by unanimous vote of the City of Lake City and the City of Red Wing. Mayor John Howe was not able to be here tonight, and so at his request, I brought that to you to enter it into the record. Mr. Chair, I would like to read that in its entirety, with your permission, or I might read just the conclusions, as you wish.
Mr. Munger, you have about 3 minutes. I'll leave it to your discretion to see how much you can fit into this.
Okay. I will begin with a resolution that was adopted by the City Council of Lake City in 2003. It is a resolution opposing legislation permitting the additional storage of spent nuclear fuel in the state of Minnesota. And I will read just the conclusion. Now, therefore, be it resolved that the City Council of the City of Lake City opposes legislation that would permit additional storage of spent nuclear fuel in the state of Minnesota. And now, the City of Red Wing adopted resolution number 5972, a resolution regarding the applications for the Prairie Island nuclear generating plant before the Minnesota Public Utilities and the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, and permanency of the high-level nuclear waste at Prairie Island nuclear generating plant. And I given the consideration of time, I believe I will begin reading in the middle of page 3. The speakers that preceded me covered much of the background material that precedes that. The clause begins, whereas the Prairie Island Nuclear Generating Plant is located within the city limits of the City of Red Wing, and the City of Red Wing desires and is responsible by statute to protect the public health, safety, and security of its citizens and the environment now and for future generations, and whereas the ethical implications of passing this problem onto future generations without a solution are unacceptable, and whereas the cost of maintenance, monitoring, and ensuring perpetual care of high-level radioactive waste at the Prairie Island Nuclear Generating Plant could unreasonably and disproportionately burden the City of Red Wing if the high-level radioactive waste remains stranded at the reactor site, And whereas Red Wing adjoins the Mississippi River and lies downriver of the Prairie Island Nuclear Generating Plant and is uniquely at risk of being endangered by planned or unplanned discharges of radioactive material from the plant to the river, and any contamination would affect the economy and valuable ecology of the river corridor. Whereas in accordance with the Minnesota Radioactive Waste Management Act, only the Minnesota legislature may permit potentially permanent storage of high-level nuclear waste in Minnesota. And whereas no studies have been initiated to ensure groundwater contamination protection under the Minnesota Radioactive Waste Management Act for the current proceedings before the Minnesota PUC. Whereas on October 2nd, 2008, the City Council adopted Resolution Number 5910 supporting the Prairie Island Nuclear Generating Plant extended power uprate and additional dry cask storage certificate of need. Now, therefore, be it resolved that the City of Red Wing finds that high-level radioactive waste storage at the Prairie Island Nuclear Generating Plant, whether in its spent fuel storage basin or at its independent spent fuel storage installation, is likely to remain on site indefinitely. Be it therefore further resolved that the City of Red Wing finds that it has interest in the applications before the Minnesota PUC, separate and distinct from other parties, and finds it in the public interest to obtain intervener status in the matters currently before the MPUC to ensure that the social, environmental, economic, and other impacts of the matters before the MPUC on the city's residents are appropriately considered and addressed. Be it further resolved that the Minnesota legislature is asked to enact legislation that would require implementation of a long-term storage strategy for the nuclear plant, including management and security of radioactive waste storage for as long as it remains on Prairie Island, continuous monitoring of the performance of the casks and facilities, continuous monitoring of the environment, including surface water and streams, groundwater, soil, and atmosphere, maintenance and periodic replacement of the casks, maintenance and complete replacement of the temporary radioactive storage facility within the first 100 years, and periodically thereafter, as recommended by the Department of Energy and industry standards. Development of a report on options for near-term waste vitrification and international benchmarking of dry cask storage technologies. Identification of any additional equipment or techniques for the safe and efficient routine and emergency handling of radioactive waste for the long term and until such time as the federal government removes waste from Prairie Island. Be it further resolved that the Minnesota legislature is asked to enact legislation to establish a radioactive waste escrow account funded by the utility that owns the nuclear generating power plant. The intent of the account being to assure that continuous and adequate security is maintained and that necessary maintenance is performed to ensure that the utility's high-level radioactive waste can be stored in a safe and environmentally sound manner for no less than the life of the plant plus 350 years. Be it therefore further resolved that the Minnesota legislature is asked to recognize the special liabilities, responsibilities, and financial burdens for neighboring communities imposed by the Prairie Island Nuclear Generating Plant and the long-term storage of its high-level radioactive waste. Provisions must be made to ensure that local governments who are responsible for the health, welfare, and safety of their communities are adequately funded for public safety and other necessary services for as long as high-level radioactive waste remains or contamination persists on the site, including fire protection.
This is Hamanga, since you have run over the time we were hoping to allow, and since we do have the resolution before us, if you wouldn't mind suspending it at this time, we would give the members an opportunity to ask.
Absolutely.
Questions.
I'll respect your wishes and my thanks to the committee for the ability to speak tonight.
Thank you, Representative Beard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Since Mayor Hamanga brought it up, there's an opportunity here to discuss just two quick points about who's going to pay for this. First of all, the utility that operates the reactors in the state now pays $500,000 per year per dry cask that's stored in the state. I think at the moment there's several million dollars. I want to say 12, 13 million. Somebody can correct me if I'm wrong. That money is actually invested in a renewable development fund. And I get those reports from the PUC because they administer that fund. And they got some pretty fantastic cutting-edge technologies that we're actually funding. We, the ratepayers right here, right now, are funding some really cool stuff that's going to be setting us up over the horizon. Now, the second point is every customer that buys from every nuclear power plant in the United States pays into a fund at the federal government, which actually is a huge political problem. There's been about $28 billion from current ratepayers that sits on hand, actually a little less than that, because at this point, I believe the agency responsible for finding the permanent repositories burned through about $7 or $8 billion of it to get to where we've got today with Yucca Mountain as it stands at this moment. There still is about $20 billion in that account that's set aside specifically for the issues that the mayor raised about what do we do to clean this up, what do we do for permanent storage. I submit to you we do have, somebody had put some good thought into it, there's a fair amount of money sitting aside, and we get past the political problem of how to fix it, we got money in the bank to do something about it.
If I may, Mr. Chair, just a point of clarification, so the record is correct, I am the former mayor of Lake City, thank you. That's fine. Okay, thank you.
Any further questions or comments for this witness? Seeing none, thank you very much. Mark Fredrickson. Fredrickson, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. For the record, my name is Mark Fredrickson. As we speak, staff is passing out a copy of the statement that I intend to present to you this evening. I'm going to forego much of the second page of that statement for brevity's sake and also to hone in and focus on some of the other points in my statement. So again, my name is Mark Fredrickson, born and raised on the western side of Minnesota in Moorhead, currently living in Rochester. I'd like to offer a personal perspective based on my experience with nuclear power issues and also speak as a representative of Downriver Alliance. Downriver Alliance is a Minnesota-based alliance of three membership-based organizations with members and chapters along the Mississippi in southeast Minnesota, western Wisconsin, and northeast Iowa. The Downriver Alliance has come to the legislature this evening and in the past to raise and articulate concerns of citizens who live, work, and recreate downwind and downriver from the Prairie Island nuclear plant and their high-level radioactive waste facility. My experience with regard to Minnesota nuclear policy issues goes back to 1992. But 15 years prior to that, I spent 8 years working on energy issues in the Black Hills of South Dakota, primarily focused on the front end of the nuclear fuel cycle, which I hope to address more this evening. Of course, here in Minnesota, the controversy and most of the talk has been around the tail end of the nuclear fuel cycle, that is, the generation of high-level radioactive waste via spent fuel and its storage. This evening, I'd prefer to be talking to you about how we might be able to get solar panels on every roof in Minnesota, how we could install small and medium wind generators on every farm in Minnesota. But alas, we're here this evening to talk about the possibility of expanding nuclear power in our state. A discussion, in my view, which is a detour in the road, a distraction, and a diversion of where we need to move our energy future. That being towards a more environmentally friendly, renewable energy base, towards a decentralized and distributed electrical generating system requiring fewer high power lines and with less of an environmental footprint. The moratorium in question tonight, as you know, was enacted largely due to the lack of progress on the national level in taking and storing our nuclear waste. The irony is not lost on me this evening that we are here talking about lifting that very moratorium at a time when we are no closer to a solution to that thorny question. The irony is further compounded in that as we speak about expanding nuclear power this evening, we're doing so on the 23rd anniversary of the accident and explosion in Chernobyl. The irony could be compounded further in that 2 days from now, we will reach the 30th anniversary of the Three Mile accident in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. So where to begin my story? It actually begins with the Three Mile Island accident, and that's why I am sitting here before you this evening. 30 years ago, my spouse and I were in downtown New York, in Manhattan, 150 miles as the crow flies from Three Mile Island at Harrisburg. We were there with friends, two Lakota families from Rosebud Reservation in South Dakota. And we were there a week prior to the Three Mile Island meltdown, and about a week hence afterwards. I had been involved in environmental issues since the 1970 Earth Day and since my graduation from high school. But that experience in New York City changed the focus of my life. It became very apparent that we need to come up with a different energy plan and proposal and policy for our nation. When we returned to the Midwest, we moved to the Black Hills of South Dakota, and there worked for 8 years, as I mentioned, primarily on energy issues and issues focusing around the front end of the nuclear fuel cycle. So I might submit to you this evening that I have more than a passing interest or a casual experience with the front end of the nuclear fuel cycle. Now, nuclear power proponents will be here to tell you that nuclear power is clean and relatively pollutant-free. I would submit to you this evening that that is far from the case. The reality is that at every stage of the nuclear fuel cycle, from uranium exploration to mining, from milling to uranium enrichment, from fuel fabrication to power generation, and lastly, but certainly not least, to the production of high-level radioactive waste, this nuclear fuel cycle, at every stage of the fuel cycle, releases radioactivity into our environment. Contrary to being non-polluting, nuclear power produces spent radioactive fuel, which is the most dangerous and the most long-lived pollution that humankind has ever produced. Now, too often, I think, out of sight, out of mind, actually becomes the rule of day. Here in Minnesota, as I mentioned, we speak a lot about the tail end of the radioactive fuel or the nuclear fuel cycle. But little is said about uranium exploration, mining, and milling. We heard a few brief comments about uranium mining earlier. But if I had the time this evening to talk to you about that front end of the cycle and my experiences in South Dakota, I could basically divide it up into two different periods, the legacy, the pollution legacy of the earlier exploration, mining, and milling that went on in the southern Black Hills, and then our experience with the problems and pollution associated with the uranium exploration that went on when I was present in South Dakota in the Black Hills. If we were able to talk about that earlier period, we could talk about the millions of tons of mill tailing that are piled along the shores of the Cheyenne River, along the very banks of the Angostura Reservoir, secured only by chain link fence, a fine sand-like powdery material, the mill tailings, that are allowed to blow in the wind, wash in the rain and the melting snow into the surface water. We'd be able to talk a little bit about how some of those mill tailings found their way into construction of roads and highways, and more egregious yet, into the construction of basements and foundations for low-income housing. If we were to talk about
to wrap up, please.
Okay. I will do so, sir, by just stating that the very front end, that radioactive... that nuclear exploration poses real risks to groundwater. And in the Black Hills, that's significant. The Black Hills are geologically significant in that they are the recharge area for some 7 aquifers, largest and well-known being the Oglala Aquifer. And I guess my last comment would be that you can't have a Monticello. You can't have a Prairie Island. You can't have a new nuclear power plant without the uranium exploration. and mining and milling and all of the pollution that is associated with those stages in the nuclear fuel cycle. Mr. Chair, committee members, thank you. I'd be willing to take any questions if there are.
Thank you. Are there any questions for Mr. Critterson? Seeing none, thank you. Next on the list, George McMahon.
He was not able to make it to you.
Thank you, Representative Mahoney. Larry Casey.
Good evening. Good evening, and thank you, Mr. Chairman and representatives. My name is Larry Casey, and I appear before you this evening as an interested citizen. So in that case, in that sense, I'm sitting here as sort of Team Casey, trying to make sense of this all. Happiness is choices, but agony is deciding. Personally, I want the agony of adding to the choices for energy production. Minnesota is growing. America is growing. Every day we're getting new citizens from Asia, Central America, Africa, Eastern Europe. That's just part of what America has been about for centuries. With that in mind, our power needs will continue to grow, as will our search for energy. When I was a child, homes built at that time typically had a 60-amp service. As a young adult, that grew to about 100-amp service. Now, if you go into most new home construction, it's a 200-amp service. So certainly, the things we're plugging in is growing along with that. There's a downside, certainly, to virtually all forms of production of energy. Coal, gas, even renewables, there's a downside to that. We've learned a great deal about nuclear energy in the last 25 or 30 years, its production and storage. We will continue to learn, and hopefully in an atmosphere of continuous improvement in how to manage those things. The decision this committee is facing is about lifting the ban to talk further about nuclear energy. We all want a nice hot shower in the wintertime. We all want a warm home in the same season. We want a cool home in the summer. We want all the appliances that go along with modern lives and all the conveniences that go along with that. The longer I live, the less I know. But I am certain that without additional energy sources, I can leave you with these two four-letter words. That's dark and cold. I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to address this committee, and if there are any questions, please fire away.
Are there any questions for Mr. Casey? Seeing none, thank you. Oh, Representative Beard. Questions, comments, please.
Dark and cold, I'm hearing an echo in here. I think someone said that before.
Next on the list, we have Mr. Crocker.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is George Crocker. I'm the Executive Director of the North American Water Office. Joining me at the table is my wife and partner at the North American Water Office and co-founder Leo Couché and Diane Rother, who is on my board of directors. I would like to start by noting that the radioactive waste that we've been hearing much discussion about today is pretty much been limited to the irradiated fuel that is produced in the reactor. But the fact of the matter is that when you're exploding uranium atoms to make heat, while you're producing the entire spectrum of elements on the periodic chart and all of their radioactive sons and daughters, and some of those are gases. And those gases are high-level nuclear waste. And the way we deal with these gases is we put them in a tank. And we hold them in the tank until there's a decay period that happens. and then we release them to the air. And this amount, speciated, reported to the NRC on an annual basis, tens, hundreds, in some years even thousands of curies per year. Bear in mind that a curie is 37 billion disintegrations per second. The National Academies of Science, in their BEER 7 report, Biological Effects of Ionizing Radiation, reports that there is no safe dose of radiation. So here's the question. Where do all of these curies of reported releases go? And the answer is, we don't know. Now, we know how to monitor very sophisticatedly for radioactivity. Remember the Russian spy that we tracked for polonium-210 throughout Europe months later? Yes. When you ask the NRC, the health department, or the industry, where does the radiation that they report go, or release, where does it go? They say, it dissipates. At the very minimum, we need to see the dispersion pattern. If you're going to be talking about lifting the ban on this stuff, you ought to at least know where the waste goes. Secondly, I'd like to talk just a minute about the cost associated with this. I find it rather disingenuous to hear people, including testimony tonight, who get very righteously indignant about ratepayer costs for an infinitesimal and temporary increase in ratepayers' rates for community-based energy development that will provide an abundance of local economic development opportunities throughout the state. And then, at the same time, supporting a reactor technology that will increase those rates 10 times, 15 times. Where's the end of it for that? It's a black hole and a black box. That, I would submit, raises a little bit of issue in terms of integrity. Finally, I would like to say a little bit about this idea of baseload. We've heard an awful lot about baseload in the past 2 days, and I would refer you to this little clipping service that I prepared for you. If you look at the first graph, you will see a average annual daily load duration curve. Very limited consumption at midnight. People wake up, turn on the coffee pot, get ready for work, the load grows, we get into that intermittent load, people go to lunch, it settles down a little bit, and then another peak is people come home, and then they go to sleep. That's a very typical load duration curve on an annual basis. Flip the page, and you will see sort of what would happen on the third day of a 100 degree August heat wave, where you'd have a spike where people come home and turn on your air conditioners. That's where we get into the peaking plants. And so, historically looking at all of this, we find a situation where we have three types of generators, which you've heard about, base load, intermittent load, and peaking load. Now, the thing that's important from this graph is that all of the consumption from intermittent load and base load on this graph, up until the Prairie Island issue, was essentially produced in Minnesota by about 20 power plants. I can name them, ask me. Then there's a few more to take care of the peakers, the gas plants. But it was a very, very small universe of plants, central station plants, that provided that. Turn to page 3, and you will see what starts to happen as we move into the post-Prairie Island era, where we finally were able to jerk renewable energy into the utility scale in North America. And this starts to help us understand the fundamental change that is happening in the industry. Most of us think that it's from coal to wind, or more generally, from fossil and nuclear fuels to renewable. Well, it's not. That happens to be a very interesting and vital attribute of the change. But the fundamental change is from central station. The economies of scale of central station are over. The economies of scale of dispersed generation are rising because the central station are essentially, even the modular ones coming on, are custom built. You manufacture the components at a distance, you ship them, and you build it on site. The modern technologies, even the switches for the smart grid, the fuel cells, the turbines, they roll off an assembly line, and the economies are the cheaper they are, the more you make on your assembly line. And so now we're learning how to put this dispersed generation all over the place. It wants to spread out. And that's what's happening. But it's not specific to base, intermediate, or peak. That's the change. And so if you look to the fourth page, you will see that now this dispersed generation is becoming increasingly dispatchable. It's learning how to follow the load duration curve. We're at the beginning point of that right now. And as we move forward, we will learn how to do a much better job of that. And what that fundamentally means is, you look at the fifth page, this whole concept of base load is deteriorating. Last night you heard some people say, we're going to go dark. You just heard it again. We'll go dark without enough base load. In the old days, they said it a little better. We're going to starve without a job while we freeze in the dark, is what they used to say. Well, those days are over because we are breaking down the distinction between base, intermediate, and peaking, and we're learning how to do a much better job of dispatchable, dispersed generation. Thank you.
Mr. Crocker, Ms. Boucher, or...
Ms. Rauter, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you to the committee, too, for allowing me to speak tonight. Mr. O'Leary last night put up a slide that said something like 70 to 80% of all Americans are for nuclear energy.
Ms. Rauter, before you continue, you do need to identify yourself for the record.
My name is Diane Rauter.
Thank you.
Okay.
Please proceed.
Again, Mr. O'Leary stated last night that something like 70 to 80% of Americans are for nuclear energy. I would venture to say the 20 to 30% that are not for it are the people living around nuclear power plants. I brought along with me tonight, via a friend, a calendar from Xcel Energy that is sent out to every household within a 10-mile radius of their plant. Within it is the emergency evacuation plan. I'm going to read sections of it to you. This is how safe a nuclear power plant is. Evacuate. If you are asked to evacuate, follow instructions promptly. Don't panic. You will have time to pack a few personal items and secure your home as if you were going on vacation. I'm sorry, if the nuclear power plant's going up, it's not going to be a vacation. If you have to evacuate, what should you take along? Prescription medicines, baby formula and diapers, cash, credit cards, checkbook, 2 changes of clothes, it goes on. First aid kit, potassium iodide. They are now handing out potassium iodide to protect us from radiation if we have to evacuate. How safe is a nuclear power plant? I grew up on a family farm 3.5 miles from Prairie Island. How many of you have grown up on a farm? Okay, I'm going to go to the area that talks about what to do for farmers. If you are a farmer, and I must tell you that we milked 90 cows, we had over 290 head of cattle on our place, we ran over 1,000 acres. If you have to evacuate, it says you are to take all your livestock and shelter them in buildings. Now, you're supposed to do this quickly, to round up 290 head of cattle and make sure they're sheltered and have enough food for God knows how long. It's going to take some time. If you're 3.5 miles from a nuclear power plant and the average wind speed in Minnesota is 12 to 15 miles per hour, how much time do you have before you're doing great harm to yourself and your other family members, because it's going to take all of you? Once you've evacuated, you don't know when you're going to come back. Of course, in here they state that farmers will be allowed to come back to feed their livestock. Again, placing yourself in danger because of a nuclear power plant. After you're allowed to return to your home, there will be people that come around and test your milk, the food for the cattle, the meat from the cattle, the milk, your garden, and they're going to tell you, in all probability, that it cannot be consumed. You've lost your income for that year and until the soil and the land is clear again. Now, everybody says nuclear is safe. 3 Mile Island, there are studies that show it isn't. That talk about farmers that have problems with their cattle, contamination, health issues with their families. In Chernobyl, people within a there's no people living within a 15-mile radius of that plant. What other industry has the ability to say, we're going to build in your backyard, and if it goes up, guess what? You're out your home, you're living, and your family's been exposed to radiation that 5 to 20 years down the road will bring up cancers in the family. When you're looking at reintroducing nuclear power within the state of Minnesota, I ask you to do a test run. Take a community and say, here, we're going to send this out to you every year. In the back, it has vouchers where you can pick up your potassium iodide. And if anything happens, you can leave, but make sure you let us know. Hang this in a window in your house. Go into any community beforehand and say, we're going to give you this information. Do you think nuclear power is safe? I would say it's not. Keep the moratorium against nuclear power plants in the state of Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you. Fouché.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Leah Fouché. I'm the Environmental Justice Director for the North American Water Office. I'd like to talk to you today about routine radiation releases. We've heard very, very much about the high-level radioactive waste, and we've heard a small fraction about the front end of the nuclear fuel chain. I don't dignify it by calling it a circle. It is not. It is a chain to which we are attached. But the routine radiation releases are those things that are liquid, they are gaseous, and they are solid. And a nuclear power plant cannot exist without them. And they go into our air, and they have to put out, I distributed a page to you. And that is from a very large document that they are required to do every year. And there are these documents for all the way back to when they first started. I received an anonymous letter in my office last year about this time asking me why this routine radiation release report was not available on the Nuclear Regulatory Commission electronic library. How I would have any idea why it wasn't there, don't ask me. But they asked me why wasn't it there. And I went and looked, sure enough, wasn't there. Coincidentally, they were trying to, of course, relicense Prairie Island over the summer, and I was given a request to prepare a flyer about tritium releases to the Mississippi River. And I will give one copy of what I have, this packet, to the chairman for, and you can make copies at your discretion in deference to the treaties. But this document, at great effort, was not forthcoming. I called our health department. I called, and they told me to call the plant at Prairie Island. I called the plant at Prairie Island. They were not available. I called the Nuclear Regulatory Commission Office of Energy Assistance, Public Assistance, and they said, oh, well, send us exactly what you want, and we'll send it out this afternoon. And I said, well, the public hearing is tomorrow for the relicensing of this facility, and I would really appreciate the document. Of course, it didn't show up. I called them in the morning, and they summarily told me I was not going to get this document before this hearing. And I can be quite unpleasant, and so I was, but I still didn't get it, obviously. And so when I got to the public hearing with the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, you would have thought I was the Queen of England. Because they rolled out the red carpet, they were very deferential, they said they would send it to me immediately after the proceeding was over, but I didn't have it then. And Mr. Wadley from the plant very graciously came over and he said he'd email it to me immediately in the morning. I did get it, but it was the next day. And I offer to you that the reason I didn't get it is because they had an undetected leak for 6 months. An undetected leak for 6 months. This might not make any sense to you, but they are required by law to do quarterly reports. Now, if they're required to do quarterly reports, how can it go for 6 months undetected? I have yet to get an answer to that question. They have no answer to that question. And they released 3,000 cubic feet of radioactive gas, and that is virtual. That is made up. They don't know. They don't know.
Ms. Folks, could you wrap up, please?
That's all I have to say.
Thank you.
We still don't know.
Any questions, members, for any of these witnesses? Representative Western.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To Diane, on those calendars, did you say they're sent out to everybody within a 15-mile radius of the plant?
I believe it's a 10-mile radius.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
So what happens is to everybody in the city of Red Wing or the city of Monticello that's within 10 miles gets a copy of these calendars? Is that what happens?
Mr. Chair, yes. The answer is yes.
Okay, thanks.
Further questions? Seeing none, thank you. Kaler?
If it's okay, Mr. Chairman, of my colleague Greg go first.
Certainly.
Mr. Beck. Chairman Hilty, Honorable Representative, my name is Gregory Beck, and I'm a licensed reactor operator at Prairie Island Nuclear Generating Plant in Red Wing, Minnesota. I'm here as a member of IBEW Local 949 on my personal time because I believe in the future of nuclear power in the United States in general, and Minnesota in particular. Allow me to give a little background about myself. I was first introduced to nuclear power in high school while growing up in Northern California when I enlisted in the Navy in 1982. After boot camp, I was sent to the Naval Nuclear Power School in Orlando, Florida. The following 6 months of classroom education I received is generally acknowledged in the industry to be equivalent to 2 years of college focusing on nuclear theory and operation as it relates to naval nuclear vessels. From there, I went to the Department of Energy site in Idaho, in the Idaho desert, for 6 months of prototype training. This involved learning how to operate reactors of the same design used in naval submarines and aircraft carriers. I was then assigned to the crew of a nuclear power attack submarine stationed out of Groton, Connecticut. The experience I gained in those years was highly accelerated due to the nature of Navy life on board of a submarine. It was where we lived while on patrol. The submarine was our home, and we took care of her. 9 years ago, I accepted the position of nuclear apprentice plant attendant at Prairie Island in Red Wing, Minnesota. The 2-year apprenticeship gave me a foundation for commercial nuclear plant operation by teaching the practical application and system knowledge required to safely operate our plant. I was assigned to monitor and operate the various air compressors, chiller units, turbines, pumps, emergency diesel generators, and auxiliary power plant equipment. In 2004, I began training to be licensed by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission as a reactor operator. This intense 18-month program was a major accomplishment, building on what I had learned during my apprenticeship and in the Navy. Subjects covered included reactor physics, metallurgy, chemistry, thermodynamics, radiological safety, and emergency preparedness. In order to maintain my license as a reactor operator, I am required to complete a minimum of 60 hours simulator training every year, comparable to a commercial airline pilot and their simulator training. We are trained in an exact replica of our control room to respond to planned emergencies using approved procedures and guidelines. I'm also required to be tested annually, achieving a minimum score of 80%. My primary responsibility as a reactor operator is to protect the health and safety of the public. The public includes, in this case, my family, my neighbors, my friends, and fellow church members. I take this responsibility with the greatest significance. We love living at Red Wing, and I'm committed to keeping it one of the greatest places in the country to live. My coworkers and I believe that nuclear power is one of the best ways to provide for the electric needs of our country, and none of us know what the ultimate outcome will be as a result of your consideration of the bill before you. Whether or not we as Minnesotans agree to move forward with expanding the role of nuclear power in the state, we should at least have an open, honest, and fair discussion of all the issues to which it pertains. I'm here tonight to ask you to pass the bill and let the discussion move forward. Let's look at all the facts and examine the real issues. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Beck. Mr. Kaler?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name's Tom Kaler. I'm the business manager of IBEW Local 160, which represents the Monticello Nuclear Plant, and I'm also the president of the IBEW State Council here in Minnesota. And again, both my local union and the State Council ask you to support 10-90-91. Greg's comments about his 18 months of training to be a licensed reactor operator, that isn't the typical apprenticeship program that most all of us would consider as a training. It's not as much of a day-to-day on-the-job checkout system. It is 18 months of full-time classroom training, so it's quite an elaborate program. I'd beg to differ with Brother Carl Cummins, when he testified, he talked about maintaining and operating these facilities. Don't want to start a union jurisdiction fight here, but IBEW 160 and 949 are the Excel, Northern States Power Excel employees membership that do the day-to-day operations and maintenance. We welcome our brothers and sisters in the building trades to help us with that maintenance. The reason I'm testifying, and I don't have a member from Monticello is currently in one of their outages, and when you talk about the resources it takes to do those outages now, they're stretching. They used to be about an 18-month cycle. They're pushing more 20 to 24 months now, but there's 1,800 people working around the clock 7 days a week during this outage up at Monticello. So when you look at the jobs, again, as Greg mentioned, our members, the Excel employees, live, work, go to church, play baseball in Monticello. They get the calendars. They have to, at their Rotary Clubs, American Legions, they have to look at the neighbors and fellow citizens and explain what they do for a living and why they do it, and they feel safe. So with that, I'll conclude.
Thank you, Mr. Kaler. Are there questions for either Mr. Beck or Mr. Kaler? Seeing none, thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Marshland?
Good evening, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Joan Marshman. I'm a resident of Florence Township in Goodhue County. I've been involved in the dry cash storage issue for since 1994. Last October, I was asked to serve on the PUC's advisory task force regarding Xcel Energy's request for uprate and additional dry cash storage. The issue of continued and additional dry cash storage at the Prairie Island plant is once again in the center stage for the state of Minnesota. The Yucca Mountain Repository has become a politically charged issue, and its future regarding accepting any spent fuel is doubtful to say the least at this time. With the uncertainty of the Yucca Mountain Repository's future, Minnesota must actively address how to safely and responsibly store the Prairie Island waste. We must enter into a careful, considered, and honest assessment of the current dry cask storage at the Prairie Island facility. It is unlikely that Yucca Mountain will ever open, and that the Prairie Island independent spent fuel storage installation may become a permanent facility. Permanent or long-range storage has a much different set of issues and impacts associated with it than does the 20 to 100-year storage term. The NRC has not done an environmental impact statement for long-term storage at reactor sites. In 1993, the Minnesota Court of Appeals regarding dry cask storage on Prairie Island said, quote, "The proposed facility is probably classified as one in which the waste is permanently stored," unquote. Xcel is now asking to double the total number of casks to 98. That will remain on site after decommissioning on Prairie Island with nowhere to go, assuming they will not apply for another relicense. The storage canisters and their performance over a long period of time are in question, and I might add the casks have not been tested to failure. It is important to address whether the Prairie Island ISSSI design and operation is adequate for interim storage. The Nuclear Waste Council, which is already in statute, 116C.71 Nuclear Waste Council, should be reactivated for the oversight of all the many nuclear waste issues and concerns that the state of Minnesota will be facing now and in the future. Thank you for letting me testify.
Thank you, Ms. Marshman. Are there any questions for this witness? Seeing none, thank you. Mr. Saunders? Mr. Saunders with us? Apparently not. Mr. Kavanaugh?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Tim Kavanaugh. I'm the General Manager of Federated Co-ops, headquartered in Princeton, Minnesota. Tonight I'm testifying on behalf of the Cooperative Network, which was the Minnesota Association of Cooperatives, the trade association for most of the cooperatives in Minnesota. I'm also a member of the Farm Supply, Grain, and Fuel Committee of Cooperative Network, which represents cooperatives in my side of the business. Minnesota is a cooperative state. In fact, it's the number one cooperative state. Member owners of co-ops are represented by boards of directors and the patrons of co-ops. They represent about $18 billion of economic activity and about 80,000 jobs in Minnesota. My cooperative is a farm supply that has 25 locations north of the Twin Cities with about $140 million in sales and about 35,000 customers. Our business is energy, farm, and consumer supplies. We serve a number of communities, including Princeton, Cambridge, Mora, Sandstone, Hinckley, and the Finlayson area. I appreciate the opportunity to speak today regarding energy policy and this legislation of lifting the ban on nuclear power. Members of Cooperative Network voted at our annual meeting in November to encourage policymakers to rescind the moratorium on the building of nuclear plants in Minnesota, that nuclear energy can be considered a viable option for baseload energy, and develop a national agenda to reprocess commercial spent fuel. On a personal note, I've lived 12 miles from the nuclear power plant in Monticello for 25 years. My cooperative is, and our members are, highly dependent on energy, and especially electricity in our area, both in agriculture and consumers, and I would certainly personally support this proposal. Thank you again for your opportunity to testify.
Yeah, thank you. Mr. Kavanaugh, are there any questions for Mr. Kavanaugh? Seeing none, thank you. Mr. Travis? Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, sir. Good evening, Mr. Chair and the members of the committee. My name is Scott Travis, and I'd actually like to start by introducing my colleague, Siri Lehman, who's with me tonight, who will start our time. Thank you.
Yes, I'm Siri Lehman. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee. And I know it's late and you're tired, but I just really ask for your attention. I'm going to share some important technology with you this evening. Thank you. Last night in this chamber, we heard testimonies for and against ending the nuclear power moratorium in Minnesota. Those opposed to lifting the ban often obscured the magnitude of our energy problem and showed a lack of understanding of the complete problem and the totality of the options available. Only nuclear energy, and specifically nuclear energy provided by integral fast reactors, can provide clean, safe, and reliable energy to accommodate the country and the world's growing population and development needs, and enough time to mitigate climate change and other dire systematic economic and resource problems. Now, this is very important. While energy, renewable energy sources and conservation are often touted as adequate solutions, there are practical limits to the amount of energy we can get from them. If we take the entire universe of known renewable energy sources, wind, solar, geothermal, tides, waves, hydro, biomass, and including aggressive conservation, the U.S., for instance, would still have about a 40 to 50% shortfall in the energy needed by the year 2040. There are only two ways to manage this deficit. One, continue burning fossil fuels, polluting fossil fuels until they run out, or to build integral fast reactor nuclear plants. I'll refer to them as IFRs. Now, I clearly grant that there are problems with the first few generations of nuclear reactor technologies and with some breeder reactor designs, but those are lessons learned long ago, and it is well past time to bring the facts about this new technology of the IFR to light and for you to consider using it. In the last 30 years, just as there has been quantum leaps in the improvements of computers, there has also been very significant advancements in nuclear reactors, notably the IFR. The fuel for these advanced reactors will be the waste material that we keep referring to tonight from the light water reactors that otherwise would be stored in Yucca Mountain for 100,000 years or more. The waste would be recycled. The subsequent waste from IFRs is small in volume and must be stored for only 300 to 500 years. The controversial Yucca Mountain nuclear waste storage facility will likely not be needed. A new objection has emerged recently that claims the capital cost of nuclear power is prohibitive compared to other energy resources. This does not square with the many studies that have been done or with General Electric, who builds these reactors and has started, who has been doing research to build these and has stated publicly that the cost would be about $3,200 per installed kWE. The major portion of the cost is regulatory, while the actual cost of the material required for this construction is surprisingly low, about $35 per installed kWE. The total capital cost for a nuclear power plant is dramatically less than the capital cost for wind or solar that only generate at their rate capacity about 25% of the time. While the government may have a guarantee, have to guarantee capital costs, subsidies, if any, would be less than for any other source of energy, including the present subsidies for fossil fuels. Many continue to be concerned about nuclear reactor safety, while we must be concerned with the safety of all energy sources. This issue must be put into perspective. The Paul Scherrer Institute in Switzerland analyzed the safety record of all industries from 1959 to 1996. Note that this period does include Three Mile Island and the Chernobyl accident. And they concluded that nuclear industry was the safest by far. The greatest energy tragedy is produced by burning of fossil fuels that cost society trillions of dollars and actually kills millions of people every year, primarily from CO2 emissions, and may ultimately cost the future generations of the planet. I have never seen a realistic quantified plan that does not include nuclear power that can provide our state, country, and world with adequate power to meet our population, development, and environmental challenges. Many seemingly good solutions to our energy problems simply do not stand up to the rigors of quantification. Because of their limitations, renewables and conservation alone cannot get us there, period. Nuclear power is here to stay no matter what Minnesota decides to do. Politically, we should be asking these two questions, committee and Mr. Chair. Are we going to provide a reasonable, sustainable future for us and our children or not? Because they won't have much of a future without adequate energy. And if we don't start now, we will run out of time and our ability to solve our monstrous energy problem, as some experts have predicted. If the ban on nuclear plants in this state is not lifted now, as it recently was in Sweden, it will surely be lifted in the future to allow for the development of integral fast reactor nuclear power, because it is clearly the best choice. And I want to thank you for your time and back up and say I'm here tonight on behalf of Joseph M. Schuster, author of a book called Beyond Fossil Fuels, and he was unfortunately not here tonight with a previous speaking engagement. Thank you for letting me submit this for the record, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Mr. Travis?
Do we have any time left?
Yes, you do.
Thank you. I'll just try to conclude briefly. Again, my name is Scott Travis, and I'd like to say that my interest in coming to you tonight is primarily based on the understanding that global climate change is the most serious and urgent problem our species has to face and has ever faced. We need to acknowledge that the longer we wait to design a new energy production regime for the state and beyond, the longer we burn fossil fuels that compound the climate change problem. To my mind, the concern that considering nuclear power will divert attention and resources from other renewable energy development assumes a false choice. We can choose to keep burning coal and gas, or we can choose alternatives. I'd like to mention that James Hansen, the lead climate researcher the federal government has, currently has motivated me very strongly in the last few years with his issued warnings about the acceleration of global climate change and natural tipping points that I presume you're familiar with, that some of which we have already come right up to the brink of, some we may have already bypassed. So time is short, and I'd like to specifically highlight the integral fast reactor technology that is one type of breeder reactor within the entire family of breeder reactors that comprises this fourth generation nuclear technology. Specifically last night, I'd like to note that Dr. Makajani conflated these two categories. He spent a good deal of time denigrating the French's efforts to design and implement breeder reactors, and cited figures that weren't fair to the fact that integral fast reactors have only been tried once in the U.S. I believe this to be the state-of-the-art technology that we have to consider now, and it's actually fairly old. The Department of Energy produced the one and only integral fast reactor that's ever produced power
in the world in Idaho in a DOE lab at Argonne Labs. It was up and running in the late 80s up until 94 when the Clinton White House actually put a silence on all the DOE staff across the board. They canceled the funding and ended the program. I don't want to take too much more time, but this is the, I think, most important new technology or technology for us to consider. Thank you.
Mr. Travis or Mr. Layman, well, first of all, Mr. Travis, do you know why the reactor that you're referring to was taken out of service?
I do. Well, in 1994, there were four reasons cited by John Kerry and Clinton's Energy Secretary, Hazel O'Leary. All of them were based on non-proliferation concerns. All of those have been discredited. And there's documentation that's quite extensive that I could provide for you.
So currently there's no reactor of the type that you're describing that's operating anywhere?
That's true. They are designing it in Korea. I'm sorry. There's one being considered in Korea and Japan and France, but there are no facilities online right now.
The difficulty I have, and this is something that comes up, you know, with other types of technology as well, I'm not quite certain that I get the intellectual connection between what the situation is in Minnesota and what progress is made or not made with this or any other kind of nuclear technology. I mean, whether we have a moratorium in Minnesota or not, it doesn't seem to me would have much effect on whether General Electric completes its research and decides to offer a reactor of this type for sale, and whether somebody somewhere on the planet decides that it's a good deal and builds one, and we see that either it works or it doesn't.
That's the point.
I don't think that if we have a moratorium in Minnesota, it would have much effect on whether that happens or not. Do you see any way that our having a moratorium in Minnesota would somehow impede progress in the development of nuclear energy to the point that we could see in Minnesota that it was demonstrably safe, cost-effective, etc.? Ms. Layman?
I would just propose that this committee look into taking a lead on this. If we really understand the deficit that we are going to come up short when we deploy renewables and conservation, and along with the depletion of fossil fuels, that Minnesota can start taking the lead on a pilot plant of this kind. And I can provide this committee with numbers that are being looked at for cost and also the documentation of this technology from General Electric. It's there. The technology is there.
Well, Ms. Layman, I don't think it's within the power of the state itself to take a lead on this. If we did not have any prohibition in Minnesota, it would still be up to one of our utilities to decide that they wanted to pursue this. And since they would already apparently be behind, I think they might find that it's prudent to wait to see what happens with this technology rather than to commit funding or research resources to a technology that's already presumably in the process of being proven elsewhere. Does that make sense?
I do understand your point. And I guess we could wait. I guess that's a scenario that could play out. I'd like to say that James Hansen has been in contact with President Obama and Al Gore himself about promoting integral fast reactors even last summer. And this is there's still a an official silence that's prohibiting any publication from any DOE staff with regard to this at all. So there's been a lot of time wasted. I do appreciate your point about the separate levels here. As in this, I would really wish this would be a national strategy initially. But I guess we have a chance to express ourselves.
Thank you. Other questions for Ms. Lehman or Mr. Travis? Seeing none, we have. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
One testifier remaining, Mr. Tom Casey. Casey, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Tom Casey. I'm not part of Team Casey. I think we all have Caseys on both sides of this discussion tonight. I represent a newly formed grassroots organization called the West Metro Global Warming Action Group. We're volunteers. Nobody's paid. And nobody's on staff. We don't have any vested interest in the outcome here financially. We form because we want to make a difference in the global warming crisis that is not just a concern to Minnesotans, but to the world in general. I'm also a registered lobbyist, so you check our records. We'll be filing goose eggs because, again, we're all paying our own way on this one. I have 4 points to make very quickly. First of all, I want to thank the eloquence of the opponents of lifting the moratorium. I think they did a great job, and I want to just touch on 4 points. Number one, energy independence. Number two, safety and clean energy. Number three, jobs. And number four, the French. Number one, we'll leave the French for last out of respect for the French. I've on one of the representative websites, we saw something about nuclear power is homegrown energy. Well, it's not homegrown energy. In fact, I have a chart I'll be distributing here, but I didn't want to distract your attention here, with citations from international organizations indicating, number one, that we are this is not going to bring us to energy independence. First of all, 6% of the world's identified uranium resources are housed in the United States. In other words, we're dependent, our uranium resources that have been identified based on 100, our uranium resources that have been identified based on $130 per kilogram price is very limited. Of course, that may go up. If the price of uranium goes up, you may discover and find more. There might be more of that. Of course, then your energy costs go up. So is that a good thing? I suspect not. Number two, about the energy independence. The Energy Information Agency report, this is an annual report in 2007, said that the source of uranium for the reactors for 2007 was 8% from the United States and 92% from foreign sources. That's for 2007. I also have another chart that shows from 2003 to 2007 that shows that the vast majority of uranium resources purchased for U.S. reactors comes from foreign sources. I'll have another chart that's distributed here, also based on the international and national sources. It's uranium enrichment. Where we buy our enriched uranium, is also disproportionately from foreign sources. So we're not going to get an energy independence anytime soon with the uranium nuclear part of the equation. Clean energy. I saw a quote by a representative that says, extreme environmentalists portray nuclear energy as unsafe. I attended the meetings last night, and I find it incredible that an expert on safety would say that he feels safer inside a nuclear reactor than he does in this room. Now, you guys don't look dangerous to me, and I don't think I am either, but I think what it does breed, and I'm...
You have to work with
yeah, maybe I should stand for... and I appreciate the levity here, but nevertheless, I do think that what it really does is when people hear this, these kinds of overstatements, We have to gain trust back, and this is not the way to gain trust, is by experts talking about how safe it is. Furthermore, as you all have heard about the Price-Anderson Act, if the nuclear power was so safe, we would not need the Price-Anderson Act. And I'd like to see a raise of hands of utilities that would still support nuclear power and at the same time ask Congress to repeal the Price-Anderson Act, because that's a limit of liability that was set by Congress to allow the nuclear energy to expand, because they knew they weren't going to carry the whole weight. The taxpayers or the public in general will be carrying the balance of any risk. And again, the risk may not be high, but it's substantial, and the nuclear power industry, I'm sure, will not support the repeal of that act. So safety is still a problem. Also, in October of 2008, the Environmental Protection Agency came out with its Yucca Mountain standards, the standards after litigation released that pertain to Yucca Mountain facilities. And I want to, this will be in your packet for your record too. There is a standard for exposure for 10,000 years, and there's another standard for exposure for the period of geological stability in that area, which is defined by the rules as up to 1 million years. And I don't know about you, but, you know, 10,000 years ago, my ancestors were living close to the ice margin in a cave somewhere in Northern Europe, and they wouldn't have foreseen that I'd be sitting here in front of the legislature taking great risk to my personal safety, just kidding, to do this. But, you know, we can see that predictability is going to be very difficult for 10,000 years, let alone in a million years. So that's something that we have to be concerned about. You know, the safety record, the nuclear energy advocates will say, well, geez, you know, there hasn't been a person hurt in the United States. Well, we don't know also the impacts on health in terms of cancer. I think that it's really hard to pin that down. But, you know, one release and we're all done for in terms of advocating nuclear power. So I do think that we have to worry about that. The other thing about and by the way, the French, of course, have not solved this safety issue either. So, on the first subject, jobs. My group has said, you know, support jobs. Don't be here opposing the unions. And so I really want to say this in all sincerity, that we do not want to fix any kind of unnecessary issues with the unions. We think that we want to see the unions come up with, the people who have the numbers here, come up with some substantial evidence that shows why nuclear power jobs are going to be more important to the American economy and the Minnesota economy versus jobs that are green jobs, that are sustainable jobs, that are safe jobs, and don't need that level of expertise that you need to have when you're sitting inside a, quote, safe nuclear reactor.
Mr. Casey, in fairness to the time restraints we put on others, testifiers, we'd ask you to get to the French pretty fast.
Okay, the French are coming now. French are, in my graph I'll show you this, we've out French the French. We, you know, everybody says 80% power of the French power is nuclear. We've out French the French. We already have more nuclear reactors than the French as of 2004, and we also have more power generation from the nuclear. So we've out French the French. No reason to beat them. We've already beat them in this. So I think in closing, this is a huge distraction. You know, us as volunteers like to be down here talking about sustainable, clean energy sources and working with you and thinking about this. We're new kids on the block. We'd like to spend the time on this rather than 2 nights in a row talking about a huge, inexpensive distraction that should be closed down tonight. So I urge you both to say no. You can still have discussions with public policy members, but don't waste their time on this matter in terms of trying to lift a moratorium and creating more incentive for us to show up and volunteer more time and parking expenses. So thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you, Mr. Casey. Questions for the testifier, Representative Westrom?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Casey, I wasn't quite sure from the beginning in your introduction and the concern you have about global warming where your testimony was going to go, and it actually went the opposite direction of what I thought. It's a bit at odds with your motives of stopping climate or global warming. in that that's one of the reasons groups have been moving towards nuclear, is because of the lack of emissions, and that's why it's been getting a new look, at least in some articles I've been reading. So I'm interested. It's interesting just to see your group with that focus come out with this position. I would like to ask you on the liability issue. I'm not sure you can draw the conclusion you exactly drew, that just because somebody has liability protection that there's a panic or fear of a great danger and not the safety. And let me just share this analogy, this illustration with you and get your reaction. Currently, the state of Minnesota, which I generally think is a fairly safe state and prudent state in how we react and take care of stuff, we have our own liability caps far lower than what Price-Anderson Act has. And so if liability caps is indicative of danger, are you suggesting the state of Minnesota is countless times more dangerous than nuclear plants? Because in many cases we have liability caps of less than $1 million, and that's the particular reason just on the I-35 bridge alone we had to have special legislation, because otherwise the victims who were crossing that dangerous bridge wouldn't have had even $1 million to divide up among all of them, because we have our own liability caps that the state of Minnesota is the sole beneficiary of, along with townships and local units of government. So I'll ask for your reaction.
Mr. Cade.
Mr. Chair, Representative Westrum, fair enough questions. First, I'll take the second one first, liability caps. There's a Supreme Court case called Duke Power versus Carolina, I think it's called SETI Group, in which there was a challenge on the constitutionality of the Price-Anderson Act. The Supreme Court at that time did say, and I'd be glad to share that by email, a copy of that decision. It indicated that the purposes of the Price-Anderson Act was to encourage the development of nuclear power. That case was also vigorously supported or vigorously contested by Duke Power in terms of the constitutionality, and the court said it was constitutional to show a difference, to have a difference between the victims of nuclear accidents versus victims of other types of accidents. So the rationale is more eloquent than I can tell you tonight, Mr. Westrum, but that's in the Supreme Court decision and supports the basis for the Price-Anderson Act liability caps. Regarding the first one about global warming, why are we here about this? It's nuclear energy is the case to prove. We haven't seen or read anything that I think tips the scale enough to say that let's go down that nuclear path. We have one good chance. We have limited resources. I know the legislature is pressed. The taxpayers are pressed. Let's spend the time on something that's going to be sustainable, and that our very smart grandchildren, won't be going back and saying, what did Grandpa and Grandma do about this thing back then when they decided to expand nuclear power? So I stand in judgment with my grandchildren, too. I hope that's an adequate answer.
Further questions for Mr. Casey? Thank you. Members, normally at the conclusion of discussion on a bill, it has been my custom to, as it is in other committees, ask if anyone in the audience wishes to testify for or against the bill. But since this was so well advertised and there were so many opportunities to sign up to testify, I think we will just skip that phase of the discussion this evening.
Drove up from Rochester today. I was here last night. I would like to say something. I'm one of the guys who gets down in the trenches and pictures you're doing. I haven't seen any of these people down in them oil switches with me.
Well, at the risk of opening the floodgates, sir, why don't you come down for a minute or two?
Thank
Thank you, sir. My name's Tom Leonard. I'm from Rochester. I'm an electrician. And my specialty, everybody I've heard in the last 2 days have specialties. Mine is high voltage splicing. I fix the grid when it goes to heck. The grid in Minnesota is not in real good shape. We just fixed the grid at IBM in Rochester. It went into the millions. We pulled all the old lead cable out and put EPR cable in, and we spliced them. Took all the oil switches out and put air switches in. That was just one place. A couple years ago, we had a 24-hour blackout in Rochester. People died. Right now, we have the largest wind tower training center probably in the upper Midwest. There's 10,000 wind towers proposed for southern Minnesota. That's a good thing. There's 20,000 proposed for Iowa, South Dakota. That's a good thing. That's going to put people to work. Short term. Long term maintenance. We are going to have a different power source. In our local, we cover Red Wing. In that area, we have a lot of our Red Wing people working at the powerhouse down there. Generally, in a year's time, there's probably 125 to 300 people killed by electricity in the United States. None of them have been killed by nuclear power. Most of the killings is by 110-volt power. The reason for that is more people use it. There's high-voltage people killed. We probably lose 120 electricians a year nationwide. And that's a bad thing. But I highly recommend that you lift the moratorium for the future. And by the time you ever implement a nuclear powerhouse, the technology will be there. But if North Dakota, South Dakota are ahead of us in the technology and implementing these things, we're going to be behind the eight ball. We have to have the tools to do the job. If you've got a business that uses a lot of energy, like IBM's and Mayo Clinic's, we have two grids coming into Rochester. One fails, the other one's supposed to transfer over. Well, when we had our blackout, that didn't happen. We had people on the operating tables, died. I just had a major heart attack 2 years ago. Was on the operating table for 10 hours. I don't want to be on the operating room table counting on wind and solar. I'd rather have another power source coming to my bedside. Thank you. And I recommend that I'd take questions if anybody wants to ask me a question, but nationwide our grid is not good. You're going to have blackouts all over the country. And I wrote home last night and I gave my friend an example. Just use a concession stand. 20 years ago, they were 30 amp. Today, they're 250 amp or 125 amp at the fairs. The reason for that is health departments made them put bigger equipment in, stainless steel equipment, and they draw more power. This room right here is probably 125 amp, 150 amp. 10 years ago, it probably wasn't. We are using more power. We're power-generated people. I guess that's it, sir. Thank you.
Members, before we bring this to a conclusion and a vote, is there any discussion to the bill?
Representative Hasper. Mr. Chairman, could we have a roll call vote?
Signal your prerogative, Representative Hackbury. Any other discussion? We would like to give the author of the bill, and actually we have at least four authors of the bill, present the last word. Before we get to that, I would like to perhaps uncharacteristically say a couple words myself. I've had a number of conversations with Representative Mahoney about this issue. I think we understand each other reasonably well. And a lot of people, I think, over the couple of years now that this has been an issue before the legislature, I think a lot of people have assumed that they knew where I stood on this issue. The truth is that, like a great number of other issues that we're called upon to consider and that I wrestle with, I did not have a position on this issue. I try to keep an open mind, particularly on something as serious as the energy future of the state of Minnesota. Some of you know one of the things that I have often said about this issue, Representative Mahoney knows very well, I have told people that to me it seems a lot like what many people say about prospects of winning the lottery. They're about the same whether you have a ticket or not. And I have felt about the moratorium issue that the prospects of a nuclear facility being built in Minnesota in the foreseeable future was probably about the same whether we had a moratorium or not. And the reason that I thought that is that there are a number of issues, some of which I have sympathy for, some of which actually not so much. I think that ultimately what we will find in the experience elsewhere where people are grappling with this issue is that it turns out not to be cost effective, that it's just going to be plain too expensive and too many problems. That's what we're seeing everywhere currently. Testimony to the contrary, I'm sorry, but if you look at what the experience is around the world and what is going on right now with projects that are being developed, there isn't a single one that isn't well over budget and well over the time estimate. There may well be a future for nuclear energy. And that's what I was talking about with Ms. Lehman and Mr. Travis. They're very enthusiastic. I spent almost an hour this afternoon talking to someone who actually asked me to call him to talk about fast reactors. The point that I was trying to make about that in the earlier discussion is that's great. If that can happen, I'd be all for it. It doesn't have anything to do with what's going on in Minnesota right now. I think the question of recycling as it relates to France has been pretty well settled, finally. It's pretty clear that with current technology, the reprocessing that some people seem to think of when they talk about recycling fuel in France, they seem to think it's like recycling newspaper or recycling plastic bottles. And I believe that the truth about that is that actually that process creates more hazardous waste than it starts out with. I do have hope for new technology. But the thing that really decided me about this issue is I'm really concerned about where are we going to get power that we need. One of the answers, I think, is to use less, a lot less. But we do have aging facilities. They're going to have to be replaced. The thing that really got me in all of this testimony was this one thing that Dr. Makshani said last night. And that is that if we imply that we have an immediate nuclear energy future in Minnesota, it will be a distraction from the course that we have in recent years already, I think, rightly and sensibly put Minnesota on to develop its own resources, its own renewable resources to the greatest extent that we can. The utilities all find that a very challenging order to try to meet. But they're doing it. Let's keep focused on the path that we have already started. Representative Mahoney, with all due respect, I'm going to be voting no on this bill. But please give us your wrap-up if you wish.
Well, Mr. Chair and members, thank you. It has been 6.5+ hours. I won't take too long to wrap this up. I will tell you that I don't know about the testifier last night, but I have actually been in those plants. And although there is this little piece of tape that you can't cross because you can't lean up against the reactor, but I have spent hours working next to the reactor. And I'm a health nut at certain levels, and my doctor tells me I'm a pretty healthy guy. So I don't know that they're the safest place in the world or safer than here, but I do believe nuclear power plants are a very safe work environment. And I believe that they have stood the test of time on safety. This bill has gone so far afield on what it is. We have people talking about gas being exploding out. We have people talking about spent fuel. We have the chairman talking about a diverse path or getting off of our path. That's not what this bill is about. This bill is about having a conversation, bringing forth evidence in front of the PUC, having the conversation, whatever our regulatory agencies are, determining it. After last night's testimony, and if what Dr. Montagnani says is very true, there'll never be a certificate of need issued. There may not be one, even if what he says is, does not come to bear. There may be other paths that we need to take. I know this is going to be a very close vote, but I have, I think it's 21 friends in this room. And I will have 21 friends when this vote's done. I'm really grateful that you all took the time to listen to all of this testimony and put your energy into figuring out if this was an idea you wanted to move forward. I'm not sure if it's a blessing or a curse whether I win or lose, but I'll know that shortly. I won't belabor this. Again, we need to have the conversation. Does it mean I'm going to put a power plant, I'm for putting a power plant in someone's backyard or in my backyard? But I do think we have to have the conversation. Please vote for 1091.
Thank you, Representative Mahoney. There being no further discussion, the clerk will take the roll.
Hilton?
No.
Falk?
No.
Westrom?
Yes.
Anderson?
Yes.
Atkins?
Yes.
Beard?
Yes.
Bly?
No.
Reinert?
No.
Gunther?
Yes.
Hasper?
Aye.
Hoppe?
Aye.
Johnson?
No.
Kalen?
No.
Knuth?
No.
Kulik Jackson?
No.
Magnus?
Yes.
Mornis?
Yes.
Obermuller?
No.
Purcell?
No.
Saylor?
No.
Welty?
No.
Carl, excuse me.
There being 9 ayes and 12 nays,
it's a blessing and a curse.
So does not pass.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee member.
Thank you. Meeting is adjourned.